Welcome to episode 58 of GBW Podcast. My name is Josh, and with me as always is Chris.
Hello, Josh.
Hello, Chris.
You're wrecking my vibe.
Wrecking? Well, the good segue there, because...
It was a bad segue, but thanks for taking it.
Tonight's episode is entitled Homewreckers, and... I'm not really sure how it's going to go, but...
it'll be fine.
Okay, here's the thing. We've been talking for a while now about doing an episode about crazy girls, just because it's a genre I certainly love, and I love seeing girls go crazy on screen.
Girls Gone Wild?
Yeah, well, that too, but...
Yeah, but that guy, didn't he go to jail?
Did he?
I thought he got charged for, like... most of the girls being like underage or something.
Oh, I can see that.
Yeah.
At any rate, when we started to think about the topic, we just realized that it's just a ridiculously huge amount of films.
There's too many.
So,
we have a tendency to put all our eggs in one basket a bit too many times.
Yeah.
So we decided to shear it down this time.
Shear it down a little bit. So I'm not sure how this is going to go because we don't have a ton of titles.
Yeah.
But maybe that's a good thing.
Well, we were talking about this, and I think we should let people know about this, is that we've decided kind of on topics now. We're going to kind of focus on the stuff we like and maybe like the titles that we think are important to us that we want to watch, rather than just try and be like so exhaustive.
Yeah, have a little more fun with it.
Because what that's doing is that's kind of stresses us out from time to time, because we're like, oh man, we got to mention so many things, and then maybe we're going to miss some, and then maybe people are going to get mad at us for missing them. And you know what? It is what it is. I want to focus on movies I've seen that I enjoyed that fit the topics. I want to talk about the handful of movies that are part of this topic that I want to actually see, because there's been past we've talked about where we were doing a topic and we're like, we feel like we're obligated to mention this title, but neither one of us has any actual interest in ever seeing this movie. So we want to kind of move away from that a little bit. So
and also, like, you know, we've only got a certain amount of, you know, free time between episodes, and oftentimes I find myself just wanting to watch another movie for the what have we watched segment, and I can't because I've got to, you know, spend all this time on research. So we decided we're just going to chill a bit about that and just see how it goes. So here's how it's going to go.
Here's how it's going.
But our episode tonight, it's going to be about ladies who are sort of disruptive to domestic life.
Yeah, ladies who kind of wedge their ways into places they're not supposed to do and generally destroy families. Homewreckers.
Homewreckers.
So.
All right. So, but before we get into those homewreckers, we're going to get into what we've watched.
Okay.
But before we get into that, I just wanted to chat a bit about something.
All right.
So every time I go to LA every couple of years just because I really love the city. And I really love Hollywood in particular. And I have a lot of interest in old Hollywood. And I really like getting the vibe for that when I'm down there. Anyway, one of the places I really like to go when I'm down there is a place called the Formosa Cafe. That's kind of famous. Well, it's very famous. It's one of the only places left in Hollywood where you can go to actually get the vibe of old Hollywood. And I think I've talked about this before. I mean, the first time I went there, I was sitting in a booth. And, you know, you're imagining when you're in the booth that, you know, Bogart could have been sitting there, or Frank Sinatra, or Lana Turner. All these people were regulars at this place. And the first time I was there, like Robert Davi from View to a Kill, and what else? He's been in tons of stuff.
You know him.
Lots of B-movies. He walked by me, and that was super cool. And then I looked out the window, and Brad Pitt was walking by outside. And it was just a really cool experience. And every time I've gone there, I've always kind of found that, like, I'm sitting, like, next to a table where there's someone talking about producing a movie or something. So it's just one of those places that's just really neat. And it had all these autographs on the wall and just a really cool decor. And what happened with this place is a couple of years ago, I guess the owners decided that it wasn't doing so well, so they decided to gut the place, and they took out all these, like, vintage booths. They took down all the pictures and tried to make it into kind of more of, like, a hipster hangout. And this bombed, and they then tried to put everything back. I guess they had everything in storage, but the vibe was kind of lost, and they lost a shit ton of customers. At any rate, the end of the day, the place closed down last week, which I find to be a real tragedy. But it's been really interesting, like, reading about the fallout of this, because, you know, a lot of people are on, like, you know, like, there's a Vintage Hollywood Facebook group I follow, and people are on there, and they're all sad about it. But what I find with places like this is, you know, when a place like this exists, people don't go to it, and then everyone cries about it when it's gone.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to remind everyone, like, if there's a place that you have that you like that, you need to go to it and support it to keep it around. And I really hope this place, you know, maybe can find a second home. I mean, I know the place is up for lease right now, and, you know, it'd be really neat if someone that really kind of got it and maybe had a place in their heart for there. I mean, it's in fucking Hollywood. You'd think someone with some dough would be able to do something with this place. So I'm hoping maybe it'll make a bit of a comeback. I mean, film fans will obviously know the place from L.A. Confidential, a very famous scene where Guy Pearce and Russell Crowe go into the Formosa, and it's actually the Formosa in the movie. Like, that shows you how old it is. And Guy Pearce mistakes Lana Turner for a prostitute, which was a pretty classic scene. But it's just one of those great places. And I'm really bummed out that that's gonna be gone. But shout out to the Formosa, and hoping that somehow it can be saved. But
yeah, maybe
knows?
We can get Tarantino to step in.
That would be awesome.
He saved the new Bev. Why can't he save Formosa?
Yeah. Well, I always thought we'd maybe go down there someday, right? Like, if we were ever in LA, and it's just kind of bummer that there's not that opportunity now. And every time I go to LA with someone, I do take them there.
Well, it's like anytime you see like a movie where people are in like a high class restaurant, and it's like a Hollywood restaurant,
yeah.
They always have the autographed pictures on the wall and everything. Yeah. I mean, that's obviously takes its inspiration from this place. It's got to.
Well, this place was not high class. Like,
but you know what I mean? Like, it's just got to get that thing, like, because you said the walls had all the pictures.
And, you know, it said, like, I remember there was a neon sign that said, like, meet me at, or no, it wasn't neon. It was just a sign that said, meet me at the Formosa. And yeah. It was just kind of a cool place. And you could kind of feel like a lot of the stuff had been there forever. And it was just really neat. And it was really kind of a little bit dark, and it felt like you were in a bar from the 40s. It was a really neat place. And, you know, I know Musso and Franks is still hopping on the Hollywood Boulevard, and that's another famous place. But and that's another place that's been around since the old days. But I just didn't get the same vibe as I got when it went in the Formosa. And I really, really like this place. So hoping that it will stick around, and or someone will step up and help it. But yeah, just if there's a place like this in your town and you really love it, you know, you gotta go there once in a while. So there's my little rant about the Formosa, but what a great place. What a cool place.
Cool.
Glad I got the opportunity to go there as many times as I did. Anyway, I guess we'll get started on these, what we've watched stuff. Okay. I've got a few more than you. So I'm going to just, actually, I'll go with the one I watched last night first.
Okay.
So I saw a new movie in the theater, and this is one that I was really trying to cram in before the end of last year, because I really thought it was going to make my top five had I seen it.
And it's also one that's been popping up on a lot of top tens. A
lot of top tens, yeah. So this is The Autopsy of Jane Doe, and this is directed by Andre Overdahl, who's the director of Trollhunter, and this is his American debut. And starring Emile Hirsch, who was in, like, Lords of Dogtown and Into the Wild. Or Lords of Dogtown?
Yeah, Lords of Dogtown.
Yeah, and Brian Cox, who, of course, was the original Hannibal Lecter in Manhunter. And
is just all around awesome.
Yeah, and been in countless movies.
Yeah.
And the story is that it's these two guys, it's a father and son that run a morgue, like a funeral home, and they do autopsies in it, obviously. And they're about to get off work for the night when the sheriff shows up with this Jane Doe corpse and says that he needs a cause of death by the next morning. So they, you know, the two guys were about to leave, so they put everything down and start to work on this autopsy. And then the film just gets weird and bizarre from there. Again, like, as usual with me, I don't really want to say too much. Remember, I'm the guy who doesn't really like to watch a lot of trailers, and I really try to not learn too much about a lot of new movies when I go, because I want to be surprised. And I think if you knew a lot about this one, it might not be as good.
This is actually one that I've heard mentioned in various places, though, to not watch the trailer because it gives away too much.
Oh, does it? Yeah. Yeah, like I really, really try to avoid trailers. I really like the relationship between Cox and Hirsch. I thought it was really natural father and son relationship, and they were really good on screen together, so I really enjoyed them. Now, this is one of those movies that I don't know. I guess I'm going to I'm going to compare it to Don't Breathe, because it suffered the same sort of fate as Don't Breathe, where it was like epic for like an hour, and then there was a turning point in the movie where it just sort of fell apart for me. But I gotta say, like, the first hour of this thing, I was like literally on the edge of my seat. Like I way more stressed out than I was in Don't Breathe. And it was really, really powerful. But then I don't know why. Like, I don't know what happens to movies in the final act, but like, it just sort of went haywire, and it just left me kind of like, eh.
I think the problem is that a lot of times filmmakers don't abide by the simplify adage, which is sometimes you don't have to make your movies so elaborate in the final act for it to work.
Yeah.
You know, like, I feel like there was like, oh, it's a final act. I got to blow my load right here in this last half an hour or 20 minutes. Yeah. And you know, I got to do it because that's what people are expecting. And you know, sometimes you don't need to do that for something to work. So I think that's what the problem is with a lot of these coming down the pike lately, is they feel like they have to do that or they're going to lose their audience, where in a lot of cases, you're going to lose your audience by doing that. In some ways, like, I have the same issue you do with Don't Breathe, right? Like, I said that that's why it was an honorable mention for me on last episode, is because so intense for the first hour.
Yeah.
And then the plot takes a turn that I just lost me somewhat. Yeah. And you know, you don't need to throw everything at the screen in the last 20 minutes for a movie to work.
Yeah. I mean, I was really disappointed because like, I was like palpably like feeling like my breathing going faster and my heart beating faster, which doesn't happen to me very often. And then it just took all that away. And I think a lot of it too is, I think filmmakers sometimes think the audience can't handle that level of intensity. And, you know, we were talking about Green Room earlier, and, you know, I'm trying to figure out what my issue has been with Green Room, because I did look back from when I watched it and I gave it 4 stars at the time. So I don't know why I've kind of, like, forgotten about what was so great about that movie. So I definitely need to revisit that, but I think that one might have gotten it right with not letting up.
That's exactly what I was telling you tonight, is I was like, the reason that movie works is because of its intensity levels. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it's not a movie that's particularly plot heavy.
Yeah.
But it's because it's just pummeling you for an hour and a half.
Yeah.
That's why that movie worked for me personally, is that I told you, I said there's a couple scenes in that movie that actually shocked me.
Yeah.
And it's very hard for me to be shocked in movies these days.
Yeah.
Like to not see something coming, and then when it happens, you just do that, oh shit, reaction, right? I had that twice during Green Room.
Yeah.
And you know, and that movie did not let off on the pedal.
And that's true.
You know, it's true. It's like, that's why it works. Not every movie has to ramp it back in the finale to give your audience room to breathe.
Yeah, like, I don't need room to breathe, and I don't need, like, comedic moments to, like, lighten the tension. Yeah. Like, you always hear that, oh, yeah, they have to throw in the, you know, bit of a few funny moments to, like, lighten the tension. Like, I don't want the fucking tension lighted.
That's one of the main hindrances to Wes Craven's 1972 movie, The Last House on the Left.
Right.
Is that they felt like they had to throw in these bumbling Keystone Cop-like characters to lighten the tension up for this movie and make it not so freaking dark and disturbing. And it throws the entire tone of the movie off.
It does. It really does. A couple of other things that I found with this movie that were a little frustrating were, like, my friend that I went with noticed that there was, you know, a lot of explaining going on, like a lot of exposition. And again, it's one of those cases where I didn't really want to know what was going on. Like, I didn't need to be told. And I think it would have been more effective had things been a little bit more of a mystery, more like unexplained, like what the fuck is going on. And another thing I noticed was, and this kind of, it reminded me of the movie National Treasure, and also a little bit of the CSI TV series, where like the characters like seem to know like everything about everything. So like, you know, like there's a certain point in the movie where like a flower is found, and like immediately they go over and like open a book to the exact page and know exactly what flower it is. And I'm like, how the fuck does that guy know that? Right. Like, and it's like a lot of that type of stuff where it's like, how the fuck would you know that unless you're like a genius or were a history major or something? So, yeah, I know I'm being a bit complainy about this, but, you know, it really kind of disappointed me, because for that first hour, I was like, this is the best movie of the year. Like, I understand why it's on everyone's or on so many top 10 lists. But by the end, I was just like, oh, man, what a total letdown. So, yeah, I don't know what to say. I mean, I kind of recommend it just for that first hour, because it was really, really good. But then... You might be feeling like me and leaving kind of empty. Another thing I did notice about it, though, is it made me really nervous about ever having to have an autopsy. So I know I'll be dead, but between this and Nacho Cerda's aftermath, I'm pretty fucking terrified of the whole thing.
Well, in the beginning of Saw 4.
Oh, yeah, Saw 4, too. Yeah, this is like graphic. Yeah. Like, I was pretty surprised. Now, I guess with all the Walking Dead and all the CSI shows and stuff, it really, people are getting pretty desensitized to this stuff, but it's still pretty gross when you're
How much does CSI really show? I've never seen the show, so I don't know.
There's been times on there where I've been like, really? Like, there's been times where I've watched that show going, man, like, my parents are watching this right now, and they used to kind of think I was weird for all the gore, and this is way gorier than Day of the Dead was, right? Like, so, yeah. So, I don't know. I mean, I can see why some people would put this on a top 10, but, I was kind of bummed out, so... There you go with my really lukewarm review.
Oh,
but
great.
That being said, I am really looking forward to Overdahl's next project, because Troll Hunter was awesome, and you know, you can see he has the chops. So hopefully next time he'll you know, just go pedal to the metal and not lighten up like he did here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So I will surprise you right now.
Ooh.
So. I actually have only 4 movies this time, but every single one of them is a new movie.
I know. That's crazy.
Do you believe that shit? That
I
actually watched some new movies? The first... And what I'm going to do is I'm going to start with the worst and work my way up.
Okay.
So I watched Kickboxer Vengeance.
Ooh.
Now, Kickboxer was a series of movies, started in 1989. Jean-Claude Van Damme starred in it. And there was, I think it's three other sequels that don't star him, that were like more direct to video kind of things, directed by like Albert Pyun and guys like that. And so I guess they decided to basically remake Kickboxer.
Okay.
In 2016. And they said, well, wouldn't it be kind of cool if we brought back Jean-Claude Van Damme for this movie? So he's in it.
Oh.
But he's not playing the same character.
Oh.
So the basic story of the original Kickboxer is that this guy travels to Thailand basically to avenge his brother's death at the hands of a imposing figure called Tong Po, who killed him in a fight. So it's like an underground fighting ring kind of deal. So he goes to Thailand to avenge the death. There's the famous scene in it with him, with them dipping their hands in the glue and putting all the broken glass on their fists and fighting. And, you know, you couldn't talk about Kickboxer without Van Damme's awesomely hilarious dancing in the bar scene. He does do his split stuff. There are the training montages where he's pulling stuff up with ropes and all that.
Van
Damme is.
Okay.
And it's actually, I like Kickboxer, the original Kickboxer. I think it's a fun movie. It came right after Bloodsport. It's got a very similar story to Bloodsport.
Yeah, I get them confused.
Yeah, that's easy to, because it's basically the same story.
Yeah.
Michael Quizzi plays the bad guy Tong Po in the original Kickboxer, and he's pretty amazing. He was I think he was like a martial arts champion who was friends with Van Damme, and then Van Damme was like, hey, I want him to be the bad guy in this movie, so okay. They hired him for it. So it's got the same story, and in this movie he's been replaced by a guy called Alain Moussy.
Van Damme has? Or?
Yeah, okay. His character. Like, Alain Moussy plays Van Damme's character from the original.
Right.
And as the movie opens, he goes to Thailand, and he knocks on this door at this castle thing and gets in all these fights because he's gone there to, like, train to take down Tong Po.
Yeah.
In this movie, Tong Po is played by Dave Bautista.
Oh, okay.
The wrestler.
Yeah.
Who's got this weird fucking bun hair and tattoos on. He's not very effective.
Really?
Okay. Imposing dude. I've seen this guy in person. Like, I've been riding a ferry back from Vancouver Island, and he was been in the line behind me in the food lineup, and I'm like, I did a double take before I figured out it was him, and he's a big dude. He's an imposing dude.
Right.
But he just doesn't do it in this movie particularly. And Jean-Claude Van Damme actually plays the character in this movie who trains.
Oh, okay.
The character to take on Tong Po. So, and he's actually the best thing in it.
Right.
Like, because he's got, like, they made him wear this fedora, and he's got these sunglasses on, and he just kind of stands off to the side, like, watching the guy train and, like, throwing all these tasks at him and then, like, laughing at him, basically.
Right.
Or just nodding his approval.
Yeah.
Like, Van Damme, he's actually really good in this movie. Like, I've always kind of had a soft spot for him anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
I've always been like, okay, he's better than Seagal, but I like Lundgren better. You know, I've always said, Dolph Lundgren, man, he's the man. But Van Damme, I can watch his movies and still be entertained, but Seagal I have a hard time with.
Yeah.
Apart from Out for Justice, like I said last
episode. We're always ripping on Seagal, though.
I know, but he deserves it. But it's just not...
Sorry, Steve.
Yeah, he's going to come after
just
us now.
Just in case you're listening.
Yeah. So I just thought the fights weren't that good in this movie. I kind of felt myself confused at the beginning because in the original Kickboxer, it starts with his footage of his brother being in Thailand and getting killed before it goes to the revenge one.
Yeah.
Whereas in this one, it starts with the guy showing up in Thailand, having these fights in this castle, and then having flashbacks to his brother being killed.
Oh, weird.
So the structure was really off. I felt myself confused for the first 15 minutes of this movie because I'm like, what the fuck's going on? He just shows up here and now he's fighting everybody. And what's the reason for this?
Yeah.
So I was kind of confused by that. The only other thing I got to say about it is it was directed by John Stockwell.
Oh.
Who was...
so this is a pretty big movie.
So, yeah, it's fairly big, I guess. Yeah. Stockwell's kind of been slumming in the low-budget action lately. He made some movies called Cat Run and Cat Run 2.
Wasn't he doing all the bikini movies for a while there?
He did...
like Blue Crush.
And... Yeah, I think he did Into the Blue, Jessica Alba and stuff. He started out as an actor. He was in Christine. He was the main, he was Arnie's best friend in Christine. He was a pretty good actor. He made a movie in 1987 that he directed called Going Undercover, which I thought was pretty fun.
Right.
But I really couldn't care less about his movies now, to be honest.
And
if Kickboxer Vengeance is any indication, I can see why he's doing these direct-to-video action movies right now. It just wasn't very inspiring. It was just didn't deliver what I wanted, and it was disappointing. So watch the original Kickboxer is what I'm saying.
All right.
All right.
All right. Cool.
So like I said, starting with the worst. It's all uphill from here.
Well, I will do The Woman.
Okay.
From 2011, directed by Lucky McKee. All right. So first of all, Lucky McKee is a director that I really liked back in 2002 when May came out.
Yeah.
As did every other horror fan. Yeah. I mean,
love May.
A breakout movie that everyone loved. And then he made a Masters of Horror episode,
which
Sick
I
Girl,
liked.
Which was pretty good with Misty Monday and Angela Bettis.
Yep.
Then he sort of got into a bit of trouble because he made a big studio movie next, The Woods, which I don't think was the best experience for him.
It was an okay movie.
Yeah, I never saw it.
It was him kind of trying to do his Argento Three Mothers thing.
Yeah.
And it was okay. I remember not minding it. I haven't seen it in a while.
Yeah, I just heard he was like having trouble like with the studio. And
well,
stuff
that
like.
I remember it being delayed a bunch.
Yeah, yeah. And then he made a movie called Red, which was based on a book by Jack Ketchum. Yeah. And he got actually removed from that movie. So I think he kind of had a real down, dark period. And this is sort of his comeback, because what happened with this movie is him and Jack Ketchum, who's a famous horror author, kind of an extreme horror guy, got together and decided to write a book and a screenplay simultaneously and make it into a movie. So it's kind of a weird thing. And I think the movie and the book came out at the same time. Now, I wanted to read the book first, but it's been a little difficult to get a hold of. So I decided to just go ahead and watch the movie. Now, this one's kind of notorious because at Sundance, when it premiered, there's a YouTube video, actually, where you can see there was this audience member that was very disturbed and offended by the movie, and he goes on this big rant, and you can see him like being like taken out of the theater, and someone was filming the whole thing, and the guy's just going on and on and on. So it got a lot of attention at that time. So I didn't know what to expect, because I like McKee, but I also and I like Ketchum too, but I did think it was kind of a weird choice. Like, McKee doesn't seem to be like an extreme horror guy. But I decided to give it a go. And what this is it's a sequel to a movie called The Offspring, based on another one of Ketchum's books. So Ketchum did like a trilogy of books. There was Offseason, The Offspring, and now The Woman. And this character, The Woman, was in Offseason, or The Offspring, and now she's got her own movie. And the movie stars Sean Bridgers, who, if you're a fan of the movie Room from last year, the one about the little kid.
That was on my top whatever last year.
Yeah, that was on your top last year. This was the guy that played the abductor, old Nick.
Oh, yeah, he was really good in it, too.
And creepy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so similar character.
Okay.
So good thing this guy's married, because he'd never get a date, I don't think.
he's not typecasting himself.
No, not at all. Yeah, he's super sleazy and gross, but he has a family out in this kind of rural area, and he's out hunting one day, and he sees this feral woman bathing in the river, and it finds out she's living in a cave, and decides to capture her and bring her back to his house and put her in a root cellar so he can tame her. But as the movie's going on, we're sort of realizing I don't think he's really wanting to tame her. I think he's more wanting to abuse her and do other things. But he gets his whole family involved, and it's just really weird. Like, Angela Bettis plays his wife, and she's really meek and obviously an abused wife. There's a daughter who's kind of against the whole thing, and then there's a really creepy kid son who's obviously taking after dad, and he's like, you know, obviously got no respect for women and so forth. And it just goes on and on with pretty much the father and son abusing this woman in the basement. And so on the surface, I mean, this is really kind of not what I'd expect from Lucky McKee. But
totally what you'd expect from Ketchum.
Totally what you'd expect from
Ketchum. Because it sounds like The Girl Next Door.
It sounds like a Jack Ketchum thing, yeah. So, you know, I have mixed feelings about this. I mean, I think it was, again, it was really well shot. I mean, you know, you can tell McKee's a good filmmaker, but I'm still kind of puzzled as to why he was doing this. Like, I'm not sure what his message was. Like, because this is a smart guy, and from what I can tell, like, a fairly sensitive guy that wants to tell decent stories. So this seems like a real kind of exploitation fest, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, the character of the woman's played by Pollyanna McIntosh. She's really great. And I think this whole movie's kind of like an allegory for, like, what, you know, what is civilized, you know, because you've got the civilized people taking in the feral woman, but they're being horrible to her. And, you know, maybe they're the ones that are uncivilized. Like, I think that's what he was trying to do, but it kind of just comes off as just being kind of like a bit of an extreme horror, you know, I'm not going to say torture porn, but like that kind of feeling, like that just kind of gross, ugly movie. Right. So I don't know. I mean, I kind of want to watch it again just to really get a good read on it. But it's going to offend a lot of people. Like, a lot of people are going to hate this movie just based on the subject matter. But I think McKee was trying to go for something more, but it just didn't really come across. So don't really know what else to say about it. But
I'm kind of lukewarm on it. I find Ketchum to be an odd one myself. Mm-hmm. Like, I've read a bunch of his books.
Have you read The Off-Season? And
I haven't. I have it at home, though.
Yeah, like, I thought Off-Season was really good. It was more of a siege movie with, like, some people, like, trapped in a farmhouse, and then all these feral, like, cannibals trying to get at them. I thought that was pretty good, but then the sequel I didn't like so much, and Girl Next Door is another one. Like, I kind of liked it, but they're all just kind of, like, dirty, you know? Well, like,
what I don't understand is that he seems to have a lot of love in the horror community for being an author, and I just find him to be very basic as a storyteller, to be honest. Like, I don't find his writing to be very challenging.
No.
Whatsoever. And I understand, like, okay, you know, like Girl Next Door, it's like, okay, there's shocking shit in this book. You know, that's, you know, oh, people are doing horrible things. And maybe that's why that book is, like, kind of looked upon that way. And then, but then I watched the movie and I was like, okay, well, it translates fine, but I'm still not enamored of this story. I mean, I know you're basing this on a true story, but
yeah,
it's not really, you know, I'm just not into it. It's just, you know, I'm just not into movies that are kind of tortury for the sake of being tortury.
Yeah.
And that's what I felt like The Girl Next Door was.
Yeah.
And what you're talking about, the woman, kind of feels like it's tortury for the sake of being tortury. And I mean, sure, maybe you're saying Lucky McKee's trying to put a message in there because it kind of jibes more with his personality than being this kind of extreme director, but you're saying it didn't work.
No.
So I've never had an interest in this movie, to be honest, because it was one of those ones that came out as Bloody disgusting selects or something. And the only actual movie in that line that I had any interest in was the movie Chop from Trent Haga.
Okay, yeah.
That he directed.
Yeah.
That's the only movie I had any interest in out of this whole line. And I don't know, man. I don't know about Lucky McKee. I don't know how to read him. Because his debut was such a strong, like, fucking 4-star movie made.
Yeah.
And then since then, it just seems to be, like, just diminishing returns, because, you know, I like Sick Girl. The Woods was okay, but then The Woman came out, and, you know, I haven't heard great things about it. And then All Cheerleaders Must Die.
All Cheerleaders
That's
Die,
supposed to be not very good either.
Oh, is it? Yeah.
I just don't know how to take him. I mean, I'm hoping that he can rebound some or something, because, like, May is such a strong movie with such a unified and unique vision that I'm just like, what's he doing making a Jack Ketchum movie?
Yeah, see, and it, like, I watched the behind the scenes. It looks like Ketchum was on set the whole time. Like, Ketchum seems like a cool guy. I mean, the guy's like almost, he's 70 years old now.
Well, he writes books under another name too that are more standard. But,
oh, does he? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I mean, it's just not really my thing either, like the kind of extreme horror stuff. And I mean, this isn't as extreme as like some things, but like the last 30 minutes is pretty out there. Like, it's goes pretty crazy. But not as crazy as I might expect. But yeah, you're right. Like, I'm just kind of like, what's Lucky McKee doing this? Like, because this was supposed to be kind of his return to his roots, right? Like, he does, it's an indie movie again, he's not having to worry about studios.
But if it was return to his roots, it'd be more of a character, quiet character movie with some psychotic moments, not a outright torture movie.
Yeah, like, it's like, I kind of wish he'd write another movie himself. Yeah. Like, you know, maybe without Ketchum involved, like, just do his own writing again. Like,
And maybe try and find someone else to be his muse rather than casting Angela Bettis and everything. Not that I dislike Angela Bettis, but
yeah, and she was really interesting in this too, because like, she's like such a like weak character, and like, I was kind of pissed off at her like through the whole movie, but then I'm like, wow, maybe that's what he's going for, like, because she's, you know, obviously abused and terrified of her husband, but at the same time, I'm kind of like, I'm not really sure what you're trying to tell me here. Like I don't want to sound like the guy that burst out of the movie and was all offended, because I wasn't offended. Like, this wasn't offending me like Serbian Film was, but it was it just left me kind of scratching my head, like, what's the point? Like, what was the point of this?
And I think it's interesting thinking about it now, how like Lucky McKee's career and Angela Bettis' career, I find, ran fairly parallel. Mm-hmm. In the sense that after May, I can't think of anything really memorable Angela Bettis has done particularly either, to be honest with you.
Like, well, she did that Carrie remake.
Yeah, and then I saw her in that Scar 3D movie, and that was terrible. I just don't know what she's doing. The only thing I can say is I am interested in seeing... she directed this movie called Roman.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Which actually stars Lucky McKee.
Yeah.
And I'm interested to see that.
Yeah, that was all right.
But I feel like that's the kind of movie that these two should be doing if they're working together.
Yeah.
Or if he's working by himself, that's the kind of movie he should be doing.
Rather than
the kind of movie that this woman one sounds like.
Well, I just feel like it just felt like wasted talent. Like the guy's clearly got a voice and he's clearly a good filmmaker. Like I just want him to put that to more use instead of just kind of pandering to the like extreme gore hounds, right? Like, because that's what this felt like. So it's too bad. It was fine. Like it wasn't like I wasn't bored. It was fine. The performances were good. This Bridgers guy is really good at what he does, and like I said, Pollyanna McIntosh as a woman was, you know, really quite frightening and raw, but just seemed like a weird. I just really want this guy to succeed because I kind of like him, like just from what I've seen. And I listened to a long interview with him on it's the Adam Green thing,
Movie Crypt.
Yeah, like that was a really good episode with him. And I really like the guy and I really want him to do well. And this, I don't think this is the right direction to be going in. Yeah, it was okay though.
All right. So my next one is an actual indie horror movie as well.
Oh.
I watched a movie called The Mind's Eye.
Ooh.
Written and directed by Joe Bagos.
Yeah.
Who made a movie a couple years ago called Almost Human, which got a little bit of notice for being like kind of an alien abduction slasher movie.
Yeah.
This is his follow-up, and this movie proves to me that he really, really, really fucking likes Scanners.
Yeah, I've heard this is like almost like a new Scanners.
It is like a new Scanners. This is basically the story is that, you know, it's about a guy who's got psychokinesis power, and the movie opens kind of like First Blood does, where it's got him like just walking down the lonely road.
Yeah.
Just seemingly being a drifter, and the cops coming up to him and being like, "What are you doing? What do you think you're doing? What, you know, just harassing him." But instead of it being like Rambo, he uses his powers to like kind of throw one of the cops back against the car and, you know, shatter all the windows in the patrol car and everything and gets himself arrested. So he ends up being arrested and being sent to this kind of like, it's kind of like a rehab house or slash a clinic for people who have this ability.
Okay.
Run by this guy called Dr. Slovak.
Dr. X.
No, Dr. Slovak, played by a guy called John Spyridakos. And it's really what it is. It's the movie is about him being there, and they're using like ways, drugs and stuff to kind of keep these psychokinesis powers in order. His girlfriend, who also has the power, happens to be there, and the doctor is kind of evil. And it's really becomes a chase movie because him and his girlfriend escape from this, you know, facility, and then they're being chased by Dr. Slovak and his henchmen. Okay. And, you know, there's the typical, you know, mind fights. There's a lot of people looking like they're really, really going to bust a blood vessel, but they also might need to take a shit because they just got that look on their face. You know, like in Scanners, where like, ooh, yeah. And their faces are just quaking. The only difference between this and Scanners is the story is definitely not as fleshed out as Scanners, but the gore is way more over the top in this movie.
Oh, okay.
Like, the movie starts really well. Joe Bagos has an actual really good... He has a good grasp of what makes a low-budget horror movie look decent. But the midsection's a little bit slow, and then it becomes, like, just an outrageous, like, psychokinesis fight with, like, you know, heads exploding and people being lifted up in the air and then dropped.
Okay.
And, you know, axes chopping heads in half and shit like that. Like, it gets really gory in the end, and the special effects are kind of cool and fun. And, you know, I really enjoyed that. But unfortunately, the acting was not that great.
Mm.
Spyridakos, who plays the evil, he just chews up so much scenery that I couldn't take him seriously, because, you know, him being this doctor who's like also got evil tendencies, he's been like kind of figuring out ways he can become psychokinetic.
Oh, okay.
And so he's got the evil, like the laughs, and that the henchmen are kind of like, one of them's got a fucking eye patch on as like a tribute to Snake Plissken, I'm assuming. One of them is played by Jeremy Gardner from The Battery.
Oh, okay.
And he's okay, but he's barely in it. And I just thought the midsection was kind of boring. I thought that this is one of those movies where it's obvious that the guy who made it has an affection for Cronenberg, for Scanners, for the genre in general.
Right.
But just doesn't have quite enough chops to make the movie feel like it doesn't have a sheen of amateurish over it.
Okay.
Like it just didn't feel like he could have gone more with it than he did,
right,
ultimately. And I felt like it just becoming a gore fest in the end kind of discounted the fact that it could have been a really interesting story about psychokinesis, and it's really just kind of a straight ahead B movie. Like, the movie fucking opens with a title card that says this movie should be played loud.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's just that kind of movie. Like, I realized though after I watched it that I'm not really a huge Scanners fan to begin with.
Right.
Like, Scanners is one of my less favorite of the Cronenberg horror movies of that era of his career. So maybe The Mind's Eye is not quite for me.
Scanners, like, all I've never seen.
Everyone
Scanners.
Knows the exploding head, right?
Yeah.
But I found The Brood and Rabid and even Shivers to be better horror movies. Like, Scanners is kind of at the bottom rung for me on his stuff. So maybe Mind's Eye isn't for me. But, you know, it's great that you want to acknowledge things you like and your inspirations, but you need to kind of massage it into something your own, and I don't feel he did enough of that in this movie. So I'm not going to say it's not worth seeing, because it's like, it's got good moments in it, but generally I feel like it's a little bit too amateurish to really fly with a lot of people. Like, if you can't handle like more indie movies with like a little bit suspect acting and a few minor pacing issues, this might not be for you.
Wow, scathing.
Yeah.
Scathing. Well, we're really selling them tonight, people.
It's not a scathing. I'm interested.
Like, just like shit on four movies.
I'm interested to see what this guy can do next. I think that if he just tightens it up and actually focuses more on having his own vision over, you know, being a homage kind of, I think he could really do something interesting.
That's cool. I think he's definitely a voice to watch, and maybe he's just still finding his footing.
Could be. I mean, I've heard this is a step up from Almost Human.
Okay.
And don't get me wrong, I didn't dislike this movie.
Yeah.
I just feel that it was rough around the edges.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, continuing on our trend.
Hey, I'm not going to be ripping anything else now.
Okay. I am, though.
Oh, okay.
Oh, am I going to be ripping?
Oh, I like it when you rip stuff, though.
Okay. So sometimes. I'm going to do a bit of a trilogy of ripping here.
All right.
Because I'm trying to get through some of my lower priced finds.
Oh, is this your Dollarama ripping?
My Dollarama ripping, yeah. So I got three here.
All right.
But we'll go through them pretty quick. And we'll go worst to best. How about that?
Okay.
Okay, so we'll start.
Now let me just clarify something before you go worst to best. You said you were going to do ripping. So is even the best really the worst?
When you hear what the best is, you're going to be like, oh, my God.
All right, I'm ready. I'm strapped in. Do this. Let's hear this.
Okay.
I hope I didn't also buy some of these.
The worst.
All right.
The worst of the three is Hillside Cannibals.
Oh, is that freaking Asylum Hills Have Eyes ripoff?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, my God. Okay, so this is... Okay, so first of all, we've got... This is directed by Lee Scott, who does a lot of those Asylum movies. This came out in
Is Lee Scott the guy who did
Bray Road?
Beast of Bray Road Frankenstein Reborn.
Yeah.
I actually kind of liked Frankenstein Reborn, I'm going to be honest.
Yeah, I haven't seen a lot of them, but I do...
Okay.
I just don't know how much he understands horror. So, like, you know, it's one of these ones where you're watching the behind the scenes, and he's like, yeah, I don't really like cannibal movies. And I'm like, well, why the fuck are you directing
one? You got hired to make a fucking cannibal movie. Maybe you need to look into liking cannibal movies a bit more, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it always bothers me when I'm like, you fucker. Like, I don't even want to direct a movie, but I'd rather me be directing it than someone who fucking doesn't even like the movies. Okay, so it starts out with that, and I found a couple of the movies here had this, that, remember that, like, early 2000s, that sort of flash editing where it was the camera would like flicker.
I hate that shit. Had
a lot of that stuff. I called it flash editing.
You know what that is? In an asylum movie, you know what that is? That's low budget hiding. That's like, we'll do flashes so you can't see how cheap this fucking movie is. That's
yeah, and it's like, is. You know, like, it'll be like a little, like, you'll hear a little, like, squeak, and then, like, something sped up or something. You
so
know?
Are they trying to, like, kind of do the Texas Chainsaw thing then?
No, it's that sort of, it was a real style in low budget filmmaking at this time, where it was like, it was an editing style that a lot of them were using.
I guess it was try and make your movie seem better than it is.
Yeah, you'd hear like a flash sound, and then the camera would pan really fast, or you know.
Right, just, I know what you mean.
It's hard to describe. Anyway, my next note just says ocular abuse, because that's what I fucking felt like while watching this.
But and here's me thinking there might be some skull fucking in it because it's a cannibal movie.
Oh, for God's sake, dude. So it opens up with this, like, group of, you know, supposedly teenagers or young people going camping.
Clarify supposedly for me. Were they really 30?
Well, yeah, that's kind of what I felt like.
All right, okay.
And they're supposed to be going camping in the, like, in the, like, hills of the Mojave Desert, right? Like, so it's just kind of an odd place to go camping, I thought, too. But there they are, and they're going to go camping. And I'm sort of watching this, and I'm like, okay, so this is, like, the prologue, like, that's going to show us, you know, like, these guys, because they start getting killed really fast. And I'm like, okay, so this is like a prologue. It's like establishing the cannibals. Nope. That's not what it is. It shows like three of the five getting offed in the first 5 minutes. Then the rest of it is just the last two basically being taken by the cannibals and then escaping a bit and then taken by the cannibals, then escaping
a bit.
These
are not very effective cannibals, like, if they keep getting away.
Of one cave, and I don't even know. Just avoid at all costs.
How effective are these cannibals that these people keep getting away from them?
It is so bad. And like they do stuff like they try and do the whole Leatherface thing. Like they're basing it on the whole Sonny Bean character, the Scottish cannibal family that took passersby into their cave by the ocean in Scotland, not in the middle of the fucking desert. And so they call themselves Sawney. Like, they can't speak, but they know the word Sawney, and I guess they know one of them's named Sawney. And they just keep, one of them will die, and then so the other one will cut off that one's face and then wear the face mask, like Leatherface, throughout. And but he's like, you know, they're trying to kind of play it for laughs sometimes. So like the lead cannibal guy will like be doing like silly things that are kind of funny, but like really out of place. And the gore is really misguided. And there's really a couple of, like, one really awkward and unnecessary nude scene. Someone drinks blood out of a breast, like a cut off breast. The sheriff, oh my God, like the worst sheriff ever. It's just quite a big guy, but like the worst actor ever too. It's freaking terrible. I'm not even going to waste any more time talking about it.
Avoid
Asylum, avoid.
I think this is one of the first movies like this, and like When a Killer Calls and some other ones. This is when they first started doing those mockbusters.
This is when they were in the thick of that.
Yeah, like the mockbusters where they'd make a movie so similar to something that was coming out, and then they'd release it to DVD like 2 weeks before, and it'd get in Blockbuster, and everyone would get confused and rent it.
Yeah.
And that's how they made all their money. So I'm probably assuming this came out on DVD like 2 weeks before Hills Have Eyes remake.
Yeah, but I was kind of thinking, okay, a cannibal movie, like usually with The Asylum, it's usually like there's usually a lot of like bad CG, and so I was kind of thinking, okay, well maybe if they're just doing like a straight up kind of can't like a like kind of a gritty movie, it might be better. Nope, it is not.
Okay,
this is awful. This is the worst cannibal movie I've ever seen.
Okay, so what's number two?
The Last Sect. David Carradine playing Van Helsing.
Oh, jeez.
So this is from 2006, starring Jonathan Dueck. Now, first of all, I think this part of this movie, there's some sort of connection with this band called the Duke Spirit, because for some reason their songs are like repeated throughout the movie, like over and over again. They're kind of like a punky female singer band like that you'd hear in the mid-90s.
Maybe it's the director's girlfriend.
Maybe, but like it was one of those ones where like, you know, it was their song was over the opening credits, then the same song showed up later, then the same song was over the end credits, and then there were the other songs by the same band, and it was just kind of like, what the hell, like why is this band's music keep playing? And they're not the greatest. They're an okay band, but they're not the greatest. They had a this is probably the worst opening credits I've ever seen, like just these really cheap, shitty, like computer generated opening credits. I mean, if you're gonna do that, just put fucking white credits on a black screen,
or just like, you know, hold up a piece of paper with their names on it.
Yeah. Yeah, do it the old like a lot of the Something Weird releases had that style of credits, but oh, so bad. So the story is about this woman named Sydney. She's a reporter. She's played by Natalie Brown, who's one of the stars of this Strain miniseries. This was long before that. And she's investigating this escort service for women that, it's an escort service for women where the women can rate the dates that they go on. So like a woman will go on a date with a guy and then she'll like publicly post like a review of what the guy was like. So basically if you're a guy on this website, you've really got to act well or you're going to get a shitty rating and never go on another date. So I thought it was kind of a unique idea that wasn't really explored at all, because it turns out that this dating service called Artemis is actually a cover for a vampire clan of female vampires.
Exact.
A female vampires that I think are lesbian vampires, because there's a few like lesbian scenes with no nudity.
Dude, aren't all female vampires lesbian vampires? Well, I've learned anything from horror movies, it's that all female
that,
vampires.
But these are shy lesbian vampires who do not take their clothes off.
Oh, so it's like Lesbian Vampire Killers, that movie.
Oh, yeah, but yeah. This is not funny.
That wasn't funny either.
Yeah.
But at least it was trying to be.
Yeah. This is, yeah, really bad. And, like, the scenes with Carradine, because it cuts between, like, the storyline with this woman, like, investigating this dating service, and then you cut to, like, David Carradine in this kind of, like, mansion with this, like, younger guy, I guess, like, his disciple, and they'll just sort of be yapping and talking about philosophy and stuff and drinking tea, and he pulled out a flute at one point and started playing the flute, and he did some Tai Chi, and you know,
like, in other words, they hired David Carradine for 3 days for
exactly
name recognition.
And he was at the end, I think he was in some scenes with the lead actress, but they were like almost parallel storylines, like they weren't really relating. The only thing that was relating them was the actor Julian Richings. Now, he's one of these character actors that he shows up in a lot of low-budget horror movies. I know him best from, he played Bucky Height in, Bucky Height? He played Bucky, I think, the kind of legendary old punk rocker in Hardcore Logo that they go visit and have an acid trip with. He's that guy. But anyway, he's been in lots of low-budget stuff, but he was pretty good in this. He played like a vampire killer, but... wow, this was another one that just plodded along, and there was no skin and barely any gore, and it was boring, and I just didn't care.
Let me just reiterate something with you. When you first started talking about this movie, you said that David Carradine plays Van Helsing.
Yeah, but I think he's Van Helsing's like long-lost
nephew.
Does
he not kill any vampires then?
Well, he's got Julian Richings doing all the like kind of fighting, and he's pretty cool, but David Carradine...
He just sips tea.
He shows up at the end for a little battle, but it's...
What kind of ineffectual fucking Van Helsing is this?
it's lame.
This ain't no fucking Peter Cushing Van Helsing.
No, this is not. No, right. This is no Anthony Hopkins.
This isn't even fucking Hugh Jackman Van Helsing. And that's a bad fucking Van Helsing right there.
I don't know if I could go that low,
no?
Dude.
It's kind of hard to go that low, I guess. Yeah, okay.
All right, so that was better than Hillside Cannibals.
Okay, now.
But it was not as good as...
Oh, shit.
The Dawn of the Dead, or Day of the Dead, directed by Steve Miner.
Are you fucking kidding me? That's the best one.
Yeah.
God, dude, don't try and send me home with any...
Have you seen it?
It's fucking terrible.
Okay, you're right. It is terrible.
Don't try and send me home with any of these goddamn movies after this.
So this one was directed by Steve Miner.
From Josh's favorite.
From 2008. Yeah, I do not like Steve Miner. So Steve Miner...
He made Friday the 13th, 2 and 3.
2 and 3, so I'll give him props made Warlock. For those.
I like Warlock.
Yeah, he made Warlock.
He made H2O.
Halloween H2O, like my least favorite Halloween movie.
I don't mind it.
Lake Placid.
Forever Young with Mel Gibson.
Yeah.
He made Soul Man.
He did make Soul Man. He did make Soul Man. But he also made this.
Okay. Yeah, this is by far the worst thing I ever saw him direct.
So again, more of that, what I talked about earlier with Hillside Cannibals, it's filled with this crash editing and those zippy camera zips all over the place. So this is not a remake of Day of the Dead, George Romero's classic. I mean, there's a couple of characters, like we've got Rhodes, Ving Rhames plays Rhodes, but this is not the Joe Pilato Rhodes. This is like just a token character named Rhodes that doesn't last very long.
Token,
that happens,
and he's
to
black.
Have his legs ripped off.
Token black character, huh?
Yeah, token black. Oh no, there's another token black character.
I know. It's, what's his face?
Nick
Cannon.
Nick Cannon. Yeah. Like, you deserve...
America's Got Talent!
You deserve...
But you don't, Nick Cannon.
Yeah, he deserved to be married to Mariah Carey. God, what a hellhole that must have been. Jesus.
And that's just talking about, you know...
No, I wasn't even talking about that. Can you imagine? Especially after that New Year's Eve shenanigans? Jesus Christ.
Okay, I just want to go on a tangent here. So Mariah Carey's like... She's like, Oh, it's the Sandman's fault, Soundman's fault, because I couldn't hear in my monitor, blah, 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 blah. Okay, first of all, it's not the Soundman's fault, because you shouldn't have been fucking lip-syncing in the first
place.
Exactly. People don't fucking pay to see you lip-sync, they pay to see you sing.
Yeah.
So it's nobody's fault but your own, you crazy fucking bitch. Like, seriously. She's nuts, dude.
That
relationship must have been great.
Did you watch the Mariah Carey year thing?
I watched clips of it.
Like, it just, never mind the whole singing thing, she just looked crazy anyways.
I know that outfit. I saw that outfit.
What was with the outfit?
I'm like, what is she wearing? Like, why is she wearing her fucking, like, gymnastics leotard from when she was in fucking grade 2? Like, what's going on here?
I don't know, man.
Oh, dude. Seriously, that marriage, though, man. Nick Cannon probably just fucking cowered in a corner trying to stay away from her and threw Vicodin at her or something.
Like, what was he thinking?
He was thinking, I get to bone Mariah Carey.
I guess. I wouldn't want to bone that.
Well, I know, but back then she didn't look as terrible as she does now. But, man, this is a bad tangent.
Wow, yeah.
Anyway, back to Day of the Dead.
Back to Day of the Dead, yeah. Okay, so we've got the Rhodes character. We've got a Bub character named Bud. You know, like a friendly zombie.
I gotta tell you, I don't remember much about this.
We've got zombies with guns, reminding me of Fast Zombies with Guns.
Oh, you love that movie.
We've got zombies that can jump really fucking high, and they can also crawl across walls and ceilings. Like, out of nowhere, like, they're zombies, but they're running zombies. Oh, and they're also zombies that can defy the laws of physics. This was written by Jeffrey Reddick, who wrote the first Final Destination.
And he wrote Tamara.
Yeah.
I didn't mind that movie, so what's going on here?
He did write Tamara. This stars Mina Suvari, like, from American Beauty. Like, I've always liked this girl, but...
Yeah.
What the heck is she doing in this? Nick Cannon. And all I wrote was, you know, sorry, but, I mean, I just wrote Nick Cannon doing the black thing. Because all he does is, like... And it's, again, it's the same thing I complained about with that Sasquatch movie, what the fuck's it called?
Lost Tapes?
No, the one by Eduardo Sanchez.
Oh, Exists.
Exists. Where, you know, the black character, like, just doing that black talking, and you're just making your sound sound dumb.
Didn't he, like, go to Minas Ferry one time, like, relax, girl? Something like that?
Yeah, and he's always saying stuff, what you doing? Where you at? You know, like, it's like, dude, just say, where are you at?
It's like,
you don't
like,
have to say, where you at? Just say, where are you at?
It just reminds me of, like in the trauma classic Redneck Zombies, there's a character like that who, like, it's purpose though on that one, because it's like kind of comedic, where he's like a black guy but he talks kind of like that stereotypical black thing, and he's like, there's this one scene where he comes running towards people. He's like, that bodacious herd of redneck zombies head this way, and I'm like, that's awesome. But it's more like, that bodacious herd of redneck zombies heading this way, like that black voice.
I can't
quite do it, but oh my god, why do they do that?
Well, and I know he's just trying to be cool, and like, I just feel like he's probably so insecure from his marriage with Mariah Carey, but like,
he's too busy cowering to work on his acting skills.
But I'm like, dude, I know you know how to talk. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah, you don't go on America's Got Talent talking like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Damn, that was a good performance.
Like, exactly. Like, I know he knows. I know he's not an idiot. Like, yeah. So why act like one? Come on, it's not for the character. You're trying to be cool. And the other thing about it is, the most awkward scene is like they're looking for guns and they're in this like weapon store, and he picks up a sword and he goes, by the power of Grayskull. And like, it's just so awkward. Like, Suvari's just kind of like looking at him, and you could tell like it was probably ad-libbed, and it was just like, oh my god, it was so awkward.
And they left it in.
Yeah. Now, the one good thing I can say about this is one of the co-stars is Annalyn McCord.
Okay.
From Excision.
Yeah.
And she's like a really good actress. And you can tell in this movie, like, she's a really good actress. And, but wow, like, she's her and Suvari, like, you're just like, what are you doing in this thing? But I will say I was fairly entertained throughout. Like, for a zombie movie, like, if I'm taking out the whole Romero thing, and I'm, you know, especially after watching the other two, it was actually not bad. But it's bad.
Well, all I got to say about it is, when the best thing about your movie is the cover art, you're in trouble.
Oh, the cover art's terrible, though.
I know, but it's still the best thing about it, because it's a zombie, like, puking or something.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't hate this. I thought it was okay. I didn't like the zombies. I don't like fast zombies generally, and I don't like CGI. And there's a lot of CGI blood. I didn't like the zombies, like, running around on the ceilings. Like, that made no sense to me.
Yeah.
But I thought the core group, aside from Cannon, but even Cannon was, because he was such an idiot, like, he was kind of entertaining to watch. And Suvari, I think, is solid. Like, I think she's a solid actress. And McCord as well. So I thought they were pretty, I didn't mind hanging out with them, but yeah, I mean, I'm certainly not recommending you go run out and buy this or anything.
Also, it is admittedly a hell of a lot better than Day of the Dead 2 Contagion.
It is. It really is. And but it's still not a very good movie. But I
no,
mean,
it's not
if you
very
have
good.
These three in your hand at Dollarama, pick the Day of the Dead for sure. But yeah, there you go. So there's three, and or you can also check my eBay page if you'd like to pick any of these up.
So how many do you got left?
That was my trilogy of terror. I've got one left.
Okay, so I'm going to plow up through my last two.
Okay.
And then we'll do your, you know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
So my next two are actually movies that, if I would have seen them before last episode, would have made my honorable mentions. Both of these. The first one is a comedy drama called Captain Fantastic, starring Viggo Mortensen.
Yeah.
And I kind of like this movie. I thought it was interesting. Because the basis of the story is that he is raising his family in the wilderness. It's kind of like a satirical Swiss Family Robinson. So he's kind of like an old hippie kind of thing. And he's got his kids out in the woods. They live in like a kind of like a cabin, no electricity, no internet, all that stuff. And he's teaching them like basic survival skills. You know, he has them do training every day where they're like, you know, doing fitness and teaches them how to cook their food on a fire and, you know, read books and fight the government and think about things like that. And so they're in this existence, which most of us would be like, that's fucking crazy. I can't be away from my fucking phone for 2 minutes, let alone be out in the wilderness with no TV and shit.
Right.
Like, I know I'm sort of like that. I mean, I go camping and then I feel cool because I'm like, I was in the wilderness for a week. Look at me.
Right.
This is the extreme of that. And so at the beginning, it's mostly about him raising his kids and like how his family's kind of strange because like the littlest girl runs around with like a skin cat thing on her head. And like they talk about politics. They have a thing where they're like they go into town every once in a while for their supplies and that. And, you know, they come up with schemes to, like, rob the stores to get their food because they're fighting the man and everything.
Yeah.
And so he finds out that his wife, who was sent away because she was having, like, depression issues, finds out that she has, you know, basically committed suicide.
Okay.
And the movie is him and his family having to leave this kind of Swiss Family Robinson thing to go back into civilization to, you know, go to the family and support the family and go to the funeral and all that stuff. And that's the basic of the movie. So I actually really liked this movie. I think Viggo Mortensen is really good in it.
Yeah.
Like, I think he's generally good in everything. I think
he's good in everything.
I think it's unfortunate that most people think of him as Aragorn from Lord of the Rings.
He was good in that though. It's the best part of that.
But when he's got like so much other stuff on his resume, that's good. I mean, he's got the Cronenberg movies.
Reflecting Skin.
Yeah, you know, he's a good actor, and he's definitely very good in this movie. I found it to be equally satirical, but also very serious in its tone, but also very comedic in its tone. You know, there's a scene where all the kids are upset because they can't, you know, have candy or something, so he steals them a cake from the supermarket, and he's like, guess what it is today? It's Noam Chomsky Day! And they have like a celebration that's Noam Chomsky Day, and they get out a poster of Noam Chomsky Day, and all praise Noam Chomsky! And I'm like,
that's pretty funny.
That's such a fucking reference that only people who are like know that he's such a friggin' like right-wing political like naysayer that...
Left.
Or is he left? Sorry, whatever it is. But you know, Noam Chomsky, he's kind of known for being fight the government.
Yeah.
And that they, instead of celebrating birthdays, they celebrate Noam Chomsky Day. It's pretty
awesome.
Awesome,
yeah.
And I just thought it was a movie that... I liked the fact that it kind of takes jabs at the way we are as human beings nowadays, how we're so dependent on, you know, just what's given to us and just, you know, dealing, just relying more on technology and internet and that than relying on your own knowledge and your own smarts. Cause there's a scene in it where he goes to his, I think it's his sister's house. And, she has two teenage sons who only care about playing Xbox.
Right.
And, you know, he like calls her out for it. He's like, you know, what are they doing? Like, what are they doing with their lives? Why aren't you teaching them anything?
Yeah.
You know, and he'll be like, look, I'll show you something. And he brings them down. And he says, how old are you? And one's 13 and one's 15. And he says to him, what's the, you know, tell me what the Bill of Rights is.
Right.
And they're like, oh, I have no idea. And then he calls down his six-year-old daughter and she explains the Bill of Rights and she starts saying it. And he's like, no, don't tell me it the way you read it. I want to know your personal opinion of it. And she fucking slams these teenage kids out by doing that.
Yeah.
And, but at the same time, the sister's kind of saying, you know, you're not raising your kids right. But when you're watching me, you're like, but he is, because he's teaching them the essentials to life.
Yeah.
Whereas his sister is not teaching her boys the essential life because they're being sheltered because they're millennials and they're easily offended.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just liked that angle to the movie because it added a really kind of interesting tone to a movie that's essentially at its core a dramedy, I guess you would call it. But I really liked it. I thought it was a really good movie. I thought it kind of got a little bit too schmaltzy near the end, but I thought solid performances by everyone, including all the kids who most of them I'd never heard of before, and just very interesting and fun.
Yeah, I definitely wanted to see this, and I saw it played for like a week at a theater in Vancouver here, but I definitely want to check it out. It reminds me a bit of a movie called The Ballad of Jack and Rose with, I think it was Daniel Day-Lewis. Do you know that one?
I don't.
But sort of a similar thing, or like even like Mosquito Coast, like where like...
Yeah, I've heard it being compared to Mosquito Coast a lot.
Yeah, no, I like movies like that. No, I definitely want to see this one for
yeah,
sure.
I remember seeing the trailer for it, and then it kind of didn't show up anywhere, and it just happened to be on PlayStation for 99-cent
right.
on-demand rental, so I was like, oh, yeah, we'll watch that.
Oh, cool.
And it would have definitely made my honorable mentions last year.
Right on.
The other movie I'm going to mention that would make my honorable mention is a movie you put on your top five.
All right.
I watched Train to Busan.
Oh, yeah.
And, dude.
It's awesome.
That's a fun fucking movie.
I told you.
A little bit too long for my liking.
Yeah.
I think it could have been shorn from 20 to 25 minutes, to be honest.
How long was it?
It was 2 hours. It was 2 hours, I think, exact.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think there's a certain moment I won't mention on air, but I'll tell you later.
Okay.
That I think the movie kind of could have cut that out and it would have been fine.
Okay, interesting.
I really thought that, like, I'm tired of zombies, like a lot of people, but I thought in this movie, it was a pretty, pretty like pedal to the metal for most of the running time. I actually thought the zombies were really well done in it.
And they were fast. Like, and it was okay.
Yeah, it was okay because, like, what I liked about it was when they got, it was like an instant when you got bit and you changed, right?
Yeah.
But I just liked how they were all like kind of contortioned.
Yeah.
Like they would get up and they'd be in all these contortioned positions that are unnatural. And I think that's because I read that the director had cast like dancers for a lot of the roles. So they were very flexible and could do that kind of movement. And I thought that movement was really cool. Like I thought it was something I hadn't quite seen in this type of movie. The action sequences were top notch.
Oh yeah,
for sure. I really liked all the scenes of them, like when they went to the train terminal and they were hunting around, like kind of 28 days later-ish, where they thought they were by themselves, and all of a sudden, they just stumbled on zombies. And you know, there's the scenes of them like just kind of pressing up against the glass, and then the glass shattering, and them just all flying out like a freaking can of sardines.
Pouring down. Yeah,
that was really cool. Yeah. The best thing about this movie, though, bar none. And you know where I'm going with this. Is the actor, his name is Dong Seok Ma. He plays one of the passengers on the train who has a pregnant wife.
Yeah.
He's so fucking badass,
he's
dude.
Badass, man.
He basically takes control of the situation, just starts fucking punching the shit out of zombies. There's a scene where he's like, they're fighting their way through a car and he's just punching the shit out of them. He grabs one and just fucking lifts him and slams him off the roof of the train. I'm like, this guy is so fucking cool.
Yeah, he really
is. I'm just watching him like, this guy's the best thing ever. And I like the interplay he had with the main characters, because the main character's like a businessman kind of father guy who's on a trip with his young daughter to Busan for to visit the mom.
Yeah.
And he's always at the beginning, because the businessman's kind of an idiot to his daughter and everyone. He's always calling him jerk or asshole. He's like, hey, asshole. Or he's like, hey, jerk.
Yeah.
And I really liked that. I thought that was fun. But yeah, this movie is pretty, like, really entertaining.
Yeah.
Like, I've been hating on zombie movies lately, but this one, man, definitely worth seeing.
Yeah.
Super fast paced, super fun, but also with kind of enough of an emotional heft to it that I thought it was, you know, very well-developed characters for what it was.
Yeah, I cared about all the characters.
Yeah, I cared about the characters, but that guy, man, that friggin' Dong Seok Ma, so fucking good.
Yeah, he was
awesome. I want to see other stuff that guy's in, because he's so good in this. But looks very, very expensive, which it was.
Yeah.
Most expensive movie made in South Korea. I think the budget is equivalent to $85 million U.S.,
Wow.
And it's just a great movie.
It's like
movie.
Low budget these days.
Like a great movie. It wouldn't quite make on my top five, but it would probably be number six if I had to go any lower than five. So yeah, definitely worth seeking out. And Wolgo USA is putting out the Blu-ray in the next couple of months. You should totally buy it. Blind buy it. If you haven't seen it, just go buy it. It's totally worth it.
I don't buy a lot of new Blu-rays anymore, and
totally,
because I try
it.
And see things in the theater, and then usually I don't buy it, but I'll be buying this one.
Yeah, it's a movie that I remember it was playing by my house even before you saw it.
Yeah,
and it played there for like a week, and I was like, oh, Train to Busan, I've heard this is good. I'm going to try and get out on one of my days off this week to see it. And I never did, and I totally regret it. But
yeah,
even on my TV, it was still like,
yeah,
totally pulse pounding and fun, and, you know, makes me feel like there is actually some life left in zombie movies after all,
because yeah,
I've really been down on them for so long. and yeah, great, great time.
All right.
Okay, so now we cue into the following. Let's limber up.
Josh's VHS Adventure! Yep. I really got to start picking better stuff here, because I came out with, when I started doing this series, it was so strong, and I was finding some cool shit, but
well, first was what, 200 Motels?
No, not 200 Motels.
Oh, that wasn't it? What was the first one?
The first one was Stigma.
Oh, Stigma, and then we had the Black Patrol, is that what it was?
Then we had Framed with Joe Don Baker.
Black Patrol.
Oh, Soul Patrol.
Soul Patrol.
And then we had
Last Riders. Oh, yeah.
Was that the last week's one?
No, there was one last week's was some, I don't remember. It
last
wasn't...
week's one was not very good, I remember.
Yeah, so, you had some Atlantis movie, too, or something.
Oh, yeah, the Atlantis
movie. So what do we got this week?
That was okay, too.
What do we got this week?
I need to know what last week's was now. I don't remember.
You don't seem very up on this one, because you don't even want to talk about it.
last week was Mata Hari. That was a bad choice.
Oh, yeah,
the
okay.
Sylvia Crystal
okay.
thing.
So what do we got this week?
This week, okay, so I really like the director Sergio H. Santiago.
Who doesn't like Sergio H. Santiago?
Filipino director. So I'm like, okay. So I found this Sergio H. Santiago movie starring Rick Hill, who plays
Deathstalker.
The original Deathstalker.
Okay, okay.
It's called Fast Gun. So I'm
never heard of it.
Okay, so we've got Sergio Santiago and Rick Hill.
New Horizons,
okay, yep.
So I'm Roger Corman production.
This is going to be all right. And no, it's not. It's it's not all right. So this guy...
This guy? Who's
okay,
this guy?
So,
Rick Hill?
Okay, so the premise is, it opens up with a bunch of, a bunch of robberies of U.S. armories. So, like, a bunch of, like, there's these robbers going around and, like, doing heists, basically, on U.S. armories and stealing all the weapons. You know, no, strangely, the U.S. armories seem to be populated with Filipino soldiers, but...
come on. Not in Trump's America.
Don't know why. But So I guess what it is it's kind of an inside job. Like the U.S. are kind of stealing from themselves.
Okay.
But then one of the guys like that's in charge of this named Nelson goes rogue and starts stealing the weapons for himself.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Is he Filipino too?
No, he's white. Okay. He's played by Robert Dreyer, who was like the lead bad guy in Savage Streets.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, that's
funny, because I was just thinking about Savage Streets the other day. Wow.
Were you?
Yeah.
So it was okay to see him, but okay, the first thing I noticed about this movie is this fucking score. Holy shit. This was such a terrible score. Sorry, composer, whoever you are. But you know what? Honestly, I don't think this
was... Are you sure it's not a library score?
I wrote must be library because it just... Everything in the score felt so wrong. Like, it felt so... Like it didn't belong there. Like someone just shoved in music.
Well, I'm sure if it's one of Corman's Filipino shot Sergio H. Santiago movies, it's a library score for
sure.
It
was so bad. The music, it was distractingly bad though. So there was that. Then we get, introduced to the Rick Hill character, who's like the sheriff of the small town, of course. But then he's like chasing down these drug runners, and in the middle of this, like, he's, you know, shooting them all. And I guess he's Fast Gun because he can like point his gun and shoot.
I get it.
But then in the middle of this, like, first action scene, there's a helicopter comes in the sky, and I'm like, guess what's going to blow up that helicopter? And how does it blow up? Rick Hill just points his gun at it, shoots a couple times, and the helicopter explodes.
How is this bad so far?
The music, man. The music wrecked it. And this opening montage of all these, like, robberies was pretty bad. But it was mildly entertaining. I'll give it that.
What's the year on this one?
This is 1988.
Oh, okay.
But then, you know, we get into the town. We're introduced to to the character of Rick played by, or the character of Jack played by Rick Hill. I wrote down Rick for everything here, but the character's name is Jack, and he's the sheriff, and he's got his sidekick named Cowboy, and he's like the other sheriff, and they're like trying to keep peace in the town. And to be honest, I don't really know why things started going weird in the town, because I was kind of falling in and out of consciousness around the middle of this. I do remember there was a biker gang at one point, and it had like a big burly biker that you'd see in like a typical biker movie with some Filipino sidekicks.
Okay.
Which was kind of weird. Brenda Bakke played the love interest who ran a bar in town, and she was in Demon Knight and Death Spa, and ironically played Lana Turner in L.A. Confidential. This also had not really much else.
Please tell me it has Vic Diaz.
No Vic Diaz.
Oh, no denied. Vic Diaz.
Now, what it did have, though, is at a certain point, they're trying to, like, they're trying to like sort of get rid of the sheriff, so they get him, basically beat him up and get him drunk, so he ends up kind of getting fired. But then there's a big siege in the town, and Rick Hill has to like sort of save the day, and then of course he has to like take his shirt off, and he's got a big giant machine gun, and he's running around the town blowing everything up, and then of course he's able to blow up a fucking jumbo jet like fighter plane with, you know, the usual two shots with his gun. But it's, yeah, it had a lot of action in that last bit, but the weird thing about it was that it was clearly like a set, like made out of plywood, like the whole town. So he'd be like running around, like it was like, I felt like I was watching like the stunt show at Universal Studios when I was watching it, like kind of like the cheap sets, and like, you know, like walls would fall down and stuff, but they were obviously so flimsy they weren't even supposed to really be there. It was just really cheap, and the music was terrible, and Rick Hill was okay, but you know, he's like a poor man's Mark Singer, which isn't saying much. And it just wasn't the Santiago I was. This was no Firecracker, you know. This was no TNT Jackson. This is no Ebony Ivory and Jade. I think you needed stronger women in this movie, to be honest.
I think he needs
a really. Santiago movies always had really strong lead characters, and this did not. And I don't know if it's Rick Hill's fault, but I just found that that's kind of what I always think of when I think of the Santiago movies. It was always these really strong lead characters that were memorable, and this one is not very memorable. So
maybe they should do like a low budget version of The Expendables. And they could get like Rick Hill,
yeah,
Don the Dragon, like Dak Rambo.
That would be awesome.
You know, and who else could we get for this this venture?
He said Don the Dragon, right?
Yeah, Don the Dragon. Mark Singer could be in there just for the hell of it.
Oh, yeah, Mark Singer could definitely.
Eric Estrada, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? This would be like, get on this shit. This would be awesome. These guys aren't going to last forever. I don't even know if they're all still alive, but we should try and hook this up.
Well, there's that book on action movies that came out last year. I can't remember what it's called, but there was a big like coffee table book on action movies. And I know when the guy had his a release of the book, he had all those guys wrote signing at Dark Delicacies. I really wish I had gone to something like that.
Maybe we could also just get like Mark Gregory to come into this.
Mark Gregory?
Yeah, dude.
From like Bronx Warriors?
Yeah. He could play trash in it too. He could be the exact same character. Think of the fucking possibilities, dude.
That would be...
And if Santiago was still with us, he could have directed it too.
Or Vince D'Amato, are you listening?
Or we could always just, you know, we could get like John Stockwell. He showed how good he is at directing action in Kickboxer Vengeance. So
that's true.
Why not?
That's true. I mean, you said you haven't heard of this. I mean, you know, I know you know you're pretty big on the action from this era.
Yeah, I'm big on action from the era, and I'm big on Santiago.
So
and,
there's probably a reason
yeah.
why you haven't heard of this. I don't think this has ever been out on DVD.
Probably not.
I have the VHS in EP mode.
EP mode, even better.
Yeah. So, yeah, a bit of a disappointment. I mean, it did have some funny moments, but it was just kind of dull and, you know, just not very interesting. And again, EP mode kind of really screws you up on VHS too, because it just looked really shitty, right? Like, it was all kind of dark all the time. And yeah, so anyway, there you go. Hopefully next week will be a better choice.
Josh's VHS Adventures!
All right, so let's get on to our homewreckers.
Okay.
Now, we don't have a lot.
No, not tons.
And I found actually a few of the ones that I'd written down, I've already talked about in the What Have We Been Watching, because I genuinely kind of like this subgenre.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So I guess we could just do like back and forth or whatever.
What I kind of did was, and we were talking about this, I don't know if you want to go with this, is I kind of pointed to two specific movies.
Right.
And I said, okay, this movie, I think, defined the adult side of these type of movies. You know, movies that were more focused on the adult audiences and their main characters were adults.
Yeah.
And then this other flip side of it are teenage protagonists.
Yeah.
Where it's, you know, a teenager who's forcing her way into a family and wrecking it. You know, so I don't know if you want to separate them like that.
Well, I think we could separate. Why don't you talk about your theory there and what the movies are?
Okay, so the theory is this. In 1987, Fatal Attraction came out. Now, that's a movie starring Michael Douglas and Glenn Close, where he's kind of like a, I think he's a lawyer in it, and he has a one-night stand with Glenn Close, but she's fucking nuts.
Yeah.
So she decides...
She defined the word crazy.
Yeah, so she decides she wants to, you know, have him for herself, but she has to deal with the fact that he has a wife played by Ann Archer and a little girl.
Yeah.
So he basically what she does is she gets more and more desperate and psychotic, and you know, things go from there. You know, it's your typical kind of movie where she has a one night stand, but it, you know, he ends up still coming to spend the weekend with her because the wife's away, and she does that whole thing like after she's been shunned, she says, "I'm pregnant." You know, like they always do in these movies.
Oh,
like,
the old pregnant trick.
I'm pregnant. And, you know, he doesn't quite buy it. And it's
does she fake a suicide too? Or
she actually, like, he goes to leave and she comes up to him and she's got her hands behind her back. And he, like, she goes to touch his face and there's blood left on his face. And he, like, notices and she slit her wrists.
Yeah.
So he has to like tie her wrists up. He's like, "Oh, baby, don't worry." You know, that kind of shit, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, because I watched this movie last week, so
it's
pretty fresh for me. It's the thing about this movie was it was a massive hit. Like, oh, yeah. This is the ultimate crazy girls home wrecking kind of movie focused for an adult audience.
Yeah.
And I feel like this is the movie because this movie was nominated for 7 Oscars.
Really?
Including Best Picture.
Wow.
Does not deserve any of that.
No.
But Best Picture, Best Actress, Best Actor, Best Director, Best Screenplay.
Was it good? Like, I kind of remember it.
It's okay. It's got memorable stuff, and it's got all the stuff everybody remembers. You know, it's got, like, you know, the bunny.
Yeah.
It's got the sink sex scene. You know, it's got Glenn Close is actually really solid, like really psychotic in this movie. It's got the finale that turns into a slasher movie, basically.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, it's entertaining. It's memorable enough, but 7 Oscar nominations, I don't get.
Well, that's the thing with this whole subgenre. Like, I really like these movies.
Yeah.
But I just want to, like, just give a little like warning to everyone, like, these are not really very good
they're
movies,
usually sleazy,
but they're really entertaining and fun.
Yeah, that's the
but
thing
they're most, not good movies.
Most of the movies I wrote down are not good movies,
but they're good to me.
So, like, the thing is for Fatal Attraction is watching it now, I realized this movie is like the most misogynistic movie we're gonna talk about.
Really?
In the sense that Michael Douglas's character basically cheats on his wife, gets away with it. There's no repercussions. He treats all the women in his life like shit. And by the end of the movie, nothing happens to him. His wife doesn't get mad at him. Nothing.
Wow.
He's scot-free. I mean, maybe it's because it's directed by Adrian Lin that this happens. I mean, Adrian Lin is infamous for making 9.5 Weeks the year before this.
Yeah, yeah.
And he also made the Lolita remake in 1997, I think it was.
Oh, okay.
So it's like this guy knows his sleaze.
And knows his homewreckers too.
And he knows his homewreckers. So he kind of did it on this one. And this was a super popular movie. But watching it now, it is.
So best picture, best director.
Best director, best writer, best actor, best actress.
Wow.
Yeah.
That blows my mind.
Yeah, and it's not worthy of that.
No.
But this is just the reason I'm bringing this up right off the bat is because of that movie's success, I think that's what caused a lot of the stuff we're going to talk about.
Yeah,
in
of
this
course.
In
yeah.
this type
the
of movie
copycats.
Are copycats of Fatal Attraction.
Yeah.
So we can talk. Do you want to talk about the adult ones, and then I'll tell you what my theory on the teen ones are?
Sure.
Okay, so let's go with that. So what do you have first for adult ones here?
Well, you know what I have first for adult ones, my friend.
It better not be Obsessed.
Oh, it is.
Wow. Called that one.
I'm sorry,
Dude, no.
I didn't have time to rewatch it, but no.
I got to tell you, I love these kind of movies too, but I can't agree with you on this.
Have you seen this?
Yes.
Dude, it is good.
No.
It's bad. I thought it was really entertaining.
The only thing I think is, I remember Ali Larter being pretty good.
Ali Larter's the crazy in this one.
I think she's pretty good, but the rest of the movie is just stone cold. Okay.
It's
go ahead.
Directed by Steve Schild. Don't know who that is. Directed by starring Idris Elba, who we all know is like Luther on the TV series.
Yeah,
and
he's going to be in the Dark Tower.
Yep. Threatening to be Bond. So we've got him. We've got Beyonce Knowles. Not that that's really anything to write home about. But
well,
I mean,
you know, according to a lot of people, it is. But I don't agree with that. But hey.
And Ali Larter.
Yeah.
From Final Destination series and Varsity Blues and et cetera, et cetera. And Heroes as the obsessed psycho. So Ali Larter plays a woman who... goes to be a temp for Idris Elba, who's like some sort of businessman.
It's always,
we don't really know what he does.
Always fucking businessman.
It's goddamn businessman. See, never wear a suit, guys. you turn into one of these guys.
Yeah.
Anyway, the difference with this movie is he is not into it. He's not banging Ali Larter. Like, she's just decides, I think through some innocuous exchange they have, she decides that he's into her.
Yeah.
But he's not into her. That's the difference with this movie than the other ones. But she becomes, as the title says, obsessed.
Right.
And becomes crazier and crazier. And I think from what I remember, at one point in the movie, she actually roofies him and rapes him to get her way. But he's not into it through the whole movie. And then the movie ends with this cat fight between Beyonce and Ali Larter in the house, where they're fighting in the attic, and then they're fighting throughout the house, and then eventually one of them dies.
But so you're making this sound better than I remember.
It was fun. I remember really enjoying this, thinking this is going to be stupid, but I thought Ali Larter was a great crazy chick.
Even me, because I'm into these movies too. This is something that Josh and I can agree on, is that we both love crazy girl movies, and we both fully acknowledge that usually they're not very good technically.
And it's not very good, but
movies.
It's really good.
This one I didn't like it.
I need to revisit it, or maybe I was in a really good mood when I watched it, but
you're on that crazy girl high, you're like, oh yeah.
It was just a good time killer. Now it's pretty
I remember being too long for starters.
And it's pretty safe. She doesn't get naked, there's no sex scene really.
Well, it's Fatal Attraction's a lot less safe than this movie, right?
Yeah, this is a pretty kind of PG.
PG 13-ish.
But I think it's fun. I mean, I when we think about this genre, it pops to mind, and that can't be for no reason. I mean, and I do remember enjoying watching it. So I do have it. I happened to come across a free copy that someone gave me. So I am going to revisit it in the coming weeks, I hope. But it certainly comes to mind when I think of this topic. So.
Yeah, not me. I knew you were going to do it, too. I was like, oh, fuck, he's going to get...
Maybe you need to watch it again.
You get a chance to talk about Obsessed. Maybe we should watch it together.
We could watch it right after we record.
Fuck, I don't know if I'm ready for that. Speaking of temps, let's talk about The Temp.
Okay, yeah, I got The Temp too.
1993's The Temp, directed by Tom Holland of Child's Play fame.
Yep.
Starring Timothy Hutton and Lair Flynn Boyle. And basically, he's a businessman. Lair Flynn Boyle is the temp secretary. She decides she likes him.
Yeah.
She decides to kill the real secretary so she can take her place permanently. Of course, Timothy Hutton has a family. Lair Flynn Boyle's character does not like that fact. Bedlam ensues. This one actually is a lot of fun.
She's great, man. I'm a big fan of hers. I mean, I know people think she's nuts in real life, but
she swayed into her role in this movie then if she's nuts in real life.
I thought she was great. I've always liked her.
I really like this movie, and I feel like this is one of the ones of this subgenre that nobody talks about.
I know.
Like, it's weird because even the DVD's out of print because I was like, oh, The Temp. I was like, I'm going to see if I can get it on DVD. And I go online and they're all selling for like $50.
Really?
Yeah. And I'm just like, you never hear anyone talk about this movie. And I'm like, I think that's weird because A, you've got a guy like Tom Holland directing it.
Yeah.
And for people like us who are into genre movies, this is the guy who made Fright Night. This is the guy who made Child's Play, you know? Yeah. He wrote Psycho 2.
Yeah.
I mean, he's got cred.
Yeah.
So why would this movie... This is what I call Tom Holland's version of Wes Craven's Red Eye. Where he... No, in the sense that they decide... They were mostly known for horror.
Yeah.
They decided to make a thriller movie. Okay, yeah. And then it's kind of was... They were decent, but nobody really talks about them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because nobody really talks about Red Eye either. And that's a fully entertaining movie as well, right?
Right.
But I thought Lair Flynn Boyle was actually really good in this too. I thought she was just the right amount of nutty.
She has those eyes.
And Timothy Crazy Hutton, eyes. You know, I don't think about Timothy Hutton much as an actor generally.
Yeah.
But he's always pretty solid in everything he's in.
He is.
You know, he was in this movie in the mid-80s called Made in Heaven, which was like this schmaltzy romantic comedy that he was really good in. He's pretty solid in every single thing he's in.
And yeah, he is.
I just really like The Temp, and I think nobody really remembers it, and it's unfortunate.
No, it's quite the cast too. Like, you had those guys.
Yeah.
And did you mention Dwight Schultz?
No.
Like, Murdoch from the A-Team is in this. And
yeah, Oliver, he was one of like the co-workers or something.
Yeah, Oliver Platt.
Yeah.
Faye Dunaway. Like,
yeah. Yeah, Faye Dunaway was the one where she gets, I can't remember what she plays in it.
Yeah.
But yeah, she was like, it was a surprise to see her in it.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Well, definitely when looking at this topic, like when I came across The Temp, I'm like, fuck, of course. And same thing. I'm like, oh, I want to see that again now.
Yeah, because I remember seeing it on VHS and just having a blast with it, right? And then I never bought it when it came out on DVD, and now I guess I should have since it's going for $50.
No kidding.
So, yeah, The Temp. I like The Temp.
Right on. Okay, well, we've got Scorned.
Oh, Scorned is, are we talking
talking Shantweed Scorned?
So the thing about this movie is that I remember it being called A Woman Scorned also.
Do you?
Yeah.
I think there may have been another one called A Woman Scorned.
Is this the one with Andrew Davis you're talking about right now?
Andrew Stevens? Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was called, when it played on cable, it was called A Woman Scorned.
Oh, okay.
And it came out on like VHS called Scorned. I actually kind of like this movie. I kind of like this movie.
It's fun.
I don't know what it is, man. Like being a teenager in the 90s was so fucking great.
Oh, Shannon Tweed.
But I mean, this is actually was actually a fun movie. Like, I like Andrew Stevens. I think he's solid too. I mean, the guy's like cheesy as shit.
Yeah,
because he's in like Terror Within and all these cheesy like B movies.
Well, he is Stella Stevens' son.
Well, I know, but I mean, I like this movie. This is was this the one directed by Damien Lee, right?
Is that the one? I actually didn't write down the director. Oops.
Yeah, I think this is the one by Damien Lee. There's also a sequel to this.
There is.
Yeah.
Scorned 2.
Yeah.
But, okay, so the first Scorned, and just in case people don't know who Shannon Tweed is for whatever reason, she's married to Gene Simmons now from Kiss.
Yep.
And, but yeah, she was like the Playboy queen playmate of the erotic thriller back in the 90s.
Yeah, she was a Playboy.
Well, there was a few of them, but she was
a Playboy playmate in the early 80s.
Yeah.
She starred in such classic films as of Unknown Origin with Peter Weller, which is a giant rat movie from the director of Rambo 2.
Yeah.
She also starred in the Surrogate. Which is a thriller where she's going to be a surrogate mom, but she decides she wants the baby for her own.
Oh, okay.
And she was also in Hot Dog the Movie, which you know me and my love of skiing movies.
Yeah.
And she definitely has the best moments of Hot Dog the Movie.
Oh, yeah. She's been in countless erotic, like, the thing about night her, eyes and all
those. The thing about her is that she gets naked in every movie.
Yeah.
But when you see her talking in interviews and that, you can tell she doesn't take herself at all seriously.
Yeah.
Like, she acknowledges, like, what her career was. And you know, that's great that she's able to do that.
And I mean, was a total fox.
She never had any pretensions of her being, like, a classically trained actress or anything like that.
No.
So, but she, I thought this movie was fun.
Yeah. So this one is Shannon Tweed's husband. It's a businessman, and
I'm sensing a trend here.
And he doesn't get a promotion, so he kills himself. So she's so mad. She is so fucking mad that she's like, I'm gonna take revenge on all those fuckers that made my husband kill himself. So she figures that Andrew Stevens was involved, who's also a businessman, and decides that she's gonna, like, infiltrate his family and fuck shit up. So she goes to the house, and under the guise that she's a tutor, so she's going to tutor their teenage son, and she sort of works her way into the family, and then just starts to fuck everyone. So she seduces the teenage son, then she just seduces the wife, then she just seduces Andrew Stevens himself, and and she basically plays them all against each other while having sex with them all. So not really going to complain too much, but I thought she was really great as this kind of, like, manipulative, you know, sort of terrible woman. And that actually had some emotional depth because of what happened to her husband. So this isn't an Oscar winner, but it's certainly a fun entry in the genre. The sequel, I can't remember too much about it. I just remember the cover had this blonde and played by this actress named Wendy Schumacher, and I had a major crush on her as a teenager. Actually, I wasn't a teenager anymore. I was a little later than that, but still, I thought she was a total babe. She didn't make a lot of movies, but I don't remember too much about the sequel. It's pretty hard to find, but might pop up on a VHS adventure one of these days, because I definitely have the VHS kicking around. Yeah.
I just looked it up. Andrew Stevens directed it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's why he had all the sex scenes with Andrew Shannon.
Of course. He's like...
Because I think he also directed Night Eyes.
I think he did, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, Andrew Stevens is smarter than he looks, you know? Yeah.
He's like, wait a minute. If I can make these movies and direct them and star in them, you know what I can do? I can
give
here?
Myself all the good scenes, yeah, and I can make them unrated.
He's like, oh, yeah, Shannon Tweed, come to Papa.
Yeah, man. Andrew Stevens was... quite the dude, that's for sure. Quite the dude. But Scorned is pretty fun. I don't know if he can even get it anymore, but
I totally forgot about that movie, man.
Yeah.
I totally need to see it again.
I actually sold my tape.
I feel
and
really,
I'm kind of kicking myself now.
I sometimes feel really pervy when I say that. Like, oh man, I can't wait to rewatch a Shannon Tweed movie. Because anyone who knows Shannon Tweed's like, oh, you fucking pervert. They just automatically think that's why you want to watch them.
But yeah, I don't really. Yeah, it's not like when I'm talking about this movie, I'm like thinking about the sex scenes though.
The thing is
like, I can't remember, like, really.
The thing is that. In that period of time in the 90s, she was in so many of these.
Yeah.
And there seemed to be one coming out like every 3 months.
Yeah.
That for one of them to actually still be remembered all this time later tells you that it's about more than just her, like, riding a dude, which she did in every single movie. Like, seriously.
Riding a dude.
Well, that was the famous scene in everyone, her riding cowgirl. Every fucking movie. Come on.
Well, she had to show off her bosom.
Well, exactly.
I can't believe I just used the word
bosom. Okay, so my next one does not star Shannon Tweed. It's a movie directed by Mark L. Lester, the man behind Commando and Class of 1984. It's from 1997. It's part of that lovely cycle of thrillers made up here in good old Canada by Mallow Film, Renee Mallow's company. It's a movie called The X, starring Yancey Butler.
What?
Who decides to stalk and harass her ex-husband's family.
Really?
Yeah.
Yancey Butler?
Yancey Butler.
Oh my God, I've never heard of this.
I saw this movie on cable in the late 90s, just after it came out, and there was this cycle of movies like The Paperboy.
Yeah.
There's a whole bunch. There was so many like of these thrillers coming out in the 90s that were like Psycho Somebody, you know, like Paperboy. Can't think of any other ones
like
really.
The Dentist.
Yeah, like yeah. And they're all Canadian shot and they were all made with like these actors who were kind of B-level. But yeah, this one's got the benefit of having Mark L. Lester directing it.
Yeah.
It's doesn't do anything much different from any of these other movies we talked about. You know, it's just basically
they're all the same.
It's all basically like you've done something wrong. You've messed up my life. It's time for me to mess up yours. But yeah, Yancey Butler from Lake Placid 2 and 3.
And 4.
And 4.
And versus Anaconda.
Yeah, and Anaconda. As a psycho chick who wants revenge on her ex-husband's family.
Actually, I don't know if she's an Anaconda.
I don't remember tons about this movie, admittedly, but I do remember that I had fun with it when I originally saw it, so I just thought it was worth mentioning for the Mark L. Lester connection alone.
Oh, I'll check that one out for sure. What's that called again?
It's called The X.
The X.
Yeah. The next one I have, while Josh writes that title down, is that this movie's not very good, but it's included just because it's famous for one thing and one thing only. It's a movie called Malicious.
Isn't it two things it's famous for?
Yeah, two things. It's from 1995.
Yeah.
Stars former teen queen, Molly Ringwald.
Yeah.
Way past her days of 16 Candles and Pretty in Pink, I gotta say. And she stars as a medical student.
Yeah.
Who gets obsessed with the star baseball player in the school. And then she decides to fuck his family up. typical story. This stars John Vernon as the detective. John Vernon's the great, great character actor. He's in Killer Clowns from Outer Space playing a cop. Surprise! And he plays a cop in almost every movie. You know him because he's got that very distinct, low register voice.
Right.
The thing is, this movie's not very good, but everybody remembers it. Well, anybody like Josh and I remembers it.
Yeah.
Because it's the first time Molly Ringwald ever took her top off in a movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're used to growing up seeing movies like 16 Candles and all that, this was a big deal for us.
Yeah.
In the mid-90s.
I've never seen her top off.
Yeah, this was a big deal in the mid-90s when this came out. Because we were like, oh yeah, Molly Ringwald, America Girl Next Door, everyone loves her. And then it's like, what the fuck is she doing? What the hell? She's pulling a Shannon Tweed right now on this boat. Because she's on a boat doing some cowgirl. So I just got to say, she's not as good a psycho chick as, say, Ali Larter or Laura Flynn Boyle or Shannon Tweed even.
You just included Ali Larter in that.
She was pretty good in that movie. That's the only thing I liked about that movie. But it's still a watchable time. I didn't mind it. I just don't think it's up to the task of matching some.
It's Laura no Flynn Obsessed. Boyle creatures.
It's better than Obsessed. Sorry.
Really?
I remember it being better than Obsessed.
Who was the victim, do we know?
I can't remember the actor's name off the top of my head.
All right, I'm just seeing if I've got any more adult ones.
I've got two more, or three more.
Adult ones?
Adult ones.
I think I'm tapped out on the adult.
They're pretty quick mentions.
Yeah.
First one I wrote down was a movie called Mother's Boys from 94.
Rebecca De Mornay?
Nope. Jamie Lee Curtis.
Sorry.
And the basic of this movie is that she abandons her family and then she returns 3 years later after her husband has got a new girlfriend and she decides she wants her family back. So she manipulates everybody, including her sons, to do her dirty deeds while being psycho herself.
Right.
And yeah, it's a fun little flick. You don't often see Jamie Lee Curtis getting to play nutty.
Yeah.
And I remember she did it really well in this movie. And it's another one that I kind of want to check out again, because I remember it was a lot of fun, even though it didn't make a hell of a lot of sense.
Right.
So Peter Gallagher plays her ex-husband.
Oh, okay.
And Joanne Whalley's Joanne Whalley Kilmer's his girlfriend.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Now, the funny story about Peter Gallagher is...
the funny story...
When this movie came out, this was 94, he was also in American Beauty, While You Were Sleeping.
Summer Lovers.
Yeah, Summer Lovers. The Underneath. My mom had a huge fucking crush on Peter Gallagher, and I think that's the reason I saw this movie, is because she rented it.
Really?
And... for my mom to rent a crazy girl's movie like this, it's like, whoa.
Wow.
She's not into that kind of stuff. So yeah. She was so into Peter Gallagher that I got to see Jamie Lee Curtis go nuts.
That's right.
I remember she like manipulates her youngest son to like just be a dick to the Joanne Whalley Kilmer character at one point. It's a fun little flick too.
Huh.
Pretty much the theme of this episode is fun flicks.
Yeah.
Because... how can you not with these? Unless you're called obsessed, how can you go wrong?
Shut up, man. Telling you. I need someone to defend me on this, please.
Maybe I'll help you out. And then I'm going to end with two big studio ones that are just quickly worth mentioning. The other adult one that is the most obvious to me after Fatal Attraction when we were talking about this is The Hand That Rocks the Cradle.
See, I don't think this fits.
It's a homewrecker movie because she's trying to steal the baby... and steal the husband.
Oh, was she trying to steal the husband too? Oh,
so
okay.
It's a total homewrecker movie.
Yeah.
Rebecca De Mornay stars in this as the crazy nanny who decides to try and kidnap the baby and try and seduce the husband. This was another big studio Hollywood movie.
This was a good one, man.
It was fun. Yeah. I like it. It's a little bit sleazy for a Hollywood movie, made by Disney, no less.
Why was it sleazy?
It was a little bit sleazy. Just the subject matter I found was so sleazy. Because there's that scene in it where they catch her, like, breastfeeding their baby something.
Yeah,
I forgot. And I'm just like, what the fuck is going on right now? I'm just like, how is that even possible? I think they kind
Can
of.
Can you imagine if they made that now?
I think they tried to explain it away that she had had a miscarriage most recently enough that she would still be producing milk. That's how they explained it in the movie.
So awesome.
But they would not make. Yeah, you're right. This would not be in.
Oh my God, it would be protested so bad.
This would not be in a movie these days. I mean, wow. Or actually, maybe it would, because, you know, there's the big thing about, you know, you shouldn't get upset at women when they're breastfeeding their babies in public.
True.
So maybe if you're breastfeeding someone else's baby, it's still okay. Maybe.
I totally forgot about that scene. That's hilarious.
So The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, I remember there was a big bunch of thrilling scenes in it involving a greenhouse.
Yeah, I do remember that.
Yeah, it's a really fun movie. It's another one that I if I stumble across it when it's on TV, I'll watch at least 20 minutes of it.
Oh, yeah, I totally want to revisit that one.
And the last adult one I want to mention is also a Michael Douglas movie. It's a Disclosure.
Yeah, I've never seen it.
From 94. Yeah. He plays a businessman.
Those darn businessmen.
This one's kind of a manipulation more than a crazy girl, because Demi Moore plays one of the new employees, and she kind of like charges him with sexual harassment.
Yeah, yeah.
So she can destroy his family and his career. So I kind of, it's very loosely in this category, but I couldn't think of where else I would fit it in.
Right.
It's based on a Michael Crichton novel, and it's directed by Barry Levinson, who made Rain Man,
right,
and Good Morning Vietnam. Did you ever notice Michael Douglas likes to be in these movies where he's like just a super like boning all the chicks kind of? Totally. You ever notice that?
Well, wasn't he like a sex addict at the time? Like in real life?
I don't know if that was around that time, but it's like. Every single movie, apart from Falling Down, he's just like, I'm going to have sex with you now. It's like every single movie. So I remember Disclosure being pretty good, but I haven't seen it in a while. But I thought I would just bring it up because if I'm going to start the adult homewrecker movies with Michael Douglas, I'm going to fucking end the adult homewrecker movies with Michael Douglas as well.
Yeah, I never got around to that one, but I've always wanted to.
Yeah, I can let you borrow it. I got the... I got the double feature Fatal Attraction Disclosure Blu-ray at home there, buddy.
No shit, really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh yeah, I'll borrow the shit out of that. All right.
So now on to teen movies.
Actually, I might just pick that up.
It's pretty cheap. Now on to teen movies, and like Fatal Attraction, there's a specific movie I point at that started this like kind of flood of these teenage homewrecker obsession movies, and that would be 1994's The Crush.
Right.
Starring Alicia Silverstone and Carrie Elwes.
Yeah.
And basically, it's... she plays kind of, I don't know if she's really a home, she's, it's more of an obsession movie in a way now that I think about it, because Carrie always lives in the house of her parents, and yeah, he's like a struggling writer and he lives above the garage, and she's trying to like seduce him,
yeah,
but it does cause strife within the family, so that's kind of why I added it in here. It was the first movie Alicia Silverstone starred in, and what a way to start your career, I guess, being like a little mini Lolita.
Yeah.
Friggin' scenes of you being like 16 years old when you filmed this movie, or 15 years old, like trying to like, in a bikini, trying to like be sexy to like Carrie Elwes' character. It's kind of disturbing.
Yeah.
It's a silly as shit movie.
Yeah.
Let's be honest with each other here. It's ridiculous, but damned if I don't find it entertaining.
Totally.
I'm still trying to figure out to this day why her dad has a fucking full scale working carousel in the fucking attic of the house and why it never fell through the ceiling. I'm still trying to figure that shit out to this day. I'm also still trying to figure out why people actually like Carrie Elwes, because he's also not very good in this movie, just like he was not very good in Saw. I don't get
Princess Bride, man.
I like Princess Bride, but he's just not that good of an actor. No. And it shows in this movie again. But it's kind of balanced out by Alicia Silverstone and just the inherent sleaziness of a story about a 15-year-old wanting to fuck a 35-year-old writer. So, yeah, The Crush. I just feel like there wasn't as many of these teen time of movies until The Crush came along, and then everyone's like, I got to jump on board with this.
That's true. And it had Jennifer Rubin and Bees.
Yeah, that's pretty memorable, too. Gotta admit, Jennifer Rubin and Bees. I always remember Jennifer Rubin from that 1988 movie, Bad Dreams.
Okay, I haven't seen that one.
With Richard Lynch and Dean Cameron.
Right.
The one where they're all the mental patients in the hospital, and then he's like the cult leader who's back from the dead, kind of like Freddy Krueger to kill him.
And speaking of Freddy Krueger,
which is ironic because she was in Nightmare on Elm Street
Dream
3
Warriors,
the year before. So, yeah.
Yeah, the only good thing about Dream Warriors.
You think so?
Yeah.
All right. What do you got for teens?
Oh, teens. Okay.
I know one of them for sure.
Teens.
I know one for sure.
Homecoming.
Okay. Oh, with Misha Barton?
I love it.
We've talked about this most recently.
We talked about this pretty recently on What Have We Watched. Yeah. Directed by Morgan J. Freeman.
I kind of like this one too.
Yeah. Misha Barton. So we've got this guy, Matt Long, and he's moved away from his hometown. And he's, you know, he was a big football star, but he's moved away. He's trying to start a new life with his girlfriend, played by Jessica Stroop, who's one of the stars of the upcoming Marvel TV series Iron Fist, which I'm looking forward to. But he's going to be, I think his jersey's going to be retired or something. So they go back to his hometown to get for this big event. And, turns out Misha Barton's still holding a torch for him. So,
now is she a teen in this movie though?
I guess so. Yeah. I mean, like it's just out of like, it's like first year of college. So she's probably like 19 or 20.
All right.
I wouldn't consider them adults. Let's put it that way. But what happens is Misha Barton still has a thing for him, so she ends up pretty much kidnapping his girlfriend by running her over.
It becomes like Misery.
It becomes like Misery in her house. And yeah, I mean, I've talked about this before. I can't remember what episode it was on, but
not that long ago.
It was pretty fun. This is another Dollarama find that was actually not a shitty one. I actually enjoyed this quite a bit, and I'll probably rewatch this a few times. I really dug it. I mean, again, like we've talked about with all of these, this isn't great. This isn't an awesome, like, excellent movie, like, technically or anything, but it was just a fun movie, and I thought Misha Barton did a really good job as the crazy chick, and I really liked the part where she made a turkey sandwich after she'd done some killing and just sat there and idly ate this turkey sandwich for, like, 5 minutes. It's pretty hilarious.
This was a movie that was sent to me to review.
Really?
Yeah. when it first came out. They're like, hey, we want to send you this movie, Homecoming, with Mischa Barton. She plays a psycho girl. I'm like, I'm in. I didn't even finish reading it. I didn't finish reading the press release. I just got to the part that says, like, psychotic. I was like, I'm in. I'm so fucking in.
Did
right
you
now.
See it? Have you watched it?
Yeah, I've seen it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I think I gave it like a 2.5 out of 4 on the site or something like that. So I'm going to talk about one that I don't like, but I know you like, so you can talk about it a bit more. Yeah. And it's a movie called Swim Fan.
Hell yeah,
in Swim 2002. Fan.
How do you not like Swim Fan?
You like it? My girlfriend likes it? I need to rewatch it.
You do.
What am I missing? Tell me what I'm missing.
I don't know.
Like, tell everyone.
You're missing the genius of Erica Christensen. Like,
tell everyone.
She's just, it's been a while, but.
She gets obsessed with this dude this on the
is, it's
team.
Just like all the other ones here, but yeah. It's just.
So yeah, what makes you like it?
Erica Christensen. I just thought she was a great crazy girl.
What has she been in?
Not much. Not much. She's been in a few things. I think she's been doing a lot of TV stuff.
Because I just thought, like, this is the only thing I know her from.
I know, but I know her from, I know, like, she is, in my brain, she's a movie star because of this movie.
Wow. That's all it takes.
Look, I love this subgenre.
I really do.
And there's just not a lot of these movies. Like, as you see, like, we're not going to have a huge list here. So, you know, you got to take them when you get them. So, like, movies like this, movies like Obsessed, I'm going to be all over them because, you know, they're pretty golden every time. They've all got the same plot, but they're all pretty fun. And I thought this girl was a really effective crazy girl. So
as far as I know, this movie's only like 80 minutes long, too. So maybe I'll have to crank it out because I know the DVD's sitting at my house.
Yeah,
so I might have to watch this one. Maybe
I totally want to rewatch it.
I just remember not liking it, and then all of a sudden I find out there's this cult of Swim Fan fans out there. I'm like, what the fuck is going on? Because you're like, oh man, I love Swim Fan.
It was fun. It was,
and then Andrew's like, oh, I like Swim Fan too. I'm like, what the fuck is going on? I'm like, what boat am I missing here?
It's a lot of fun. I mean, I do want to revisit it because I've only seen it the once, and this came out in, what, 2002?
Yeah.
So it's like a 15 years old now, but I did really enjoy it, and I thought she was really good. So, yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's called Swim Fan. She's obsessed with a swimmer.
I know. It just, I don't know about it. I don't know. I'm going to mention one that I haven't seen, but I'm just going to, because I have actually got this movie on my my eBay watch list because I might buy it. It's a movie from 1998 called Wicked. Starring Julia Stiles.
Yeah.
Now.
But she doesn't seem like she's going to be a good crazy girl.
It just sounds demented, though, because the plot summary is like she plays this 16-year-old girl who kills her mom. So she can take the place of the mom in the family and try and have sex with her dad. As soon as I read that, I'm like, fuck, I'm in.
This subgenre is so awesome.
I'm like, I'm so in right now. So I went online and I'm like, oh shit, the DVD's out of print. Oh, but no. I can get the Region 2 UK Blu-ray for DVD for $9. I'm like, thinking about it. I mean, Julia Stiles, everyone knows her from, like, you know, the Bourne movies.
Yeah.
Save the Last Dance.
How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days?
Yeah, like, she's basically, like, very vanilla-y.
Yeah,
like, she's totally. She's very, like, safe. Like, the only time anyone remembers her not being safe is when she was in Dexter.
Okay.
For a few seasons there. Yeah. But most of the time, she's just that all-American girl next door, right?
Yeah.
So I'm like, I'm down with seeing Julia Stiles try and fuck her dad. I'm down with this. Let's watch this shit. Like, seriously. I'm like, I don't know how she kills her mom, but I'm sure it's awesome.
Okay. So, yeah. I didn't know anything about this, but yeah, I'm totally sold out.
So wicked. So wicked.
That sounds wicked.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I only got one more.
All right. Well,
it's more than one, but they're all the same.
I just got to write down wicked.
He's going to write. So I'll finish.
You're going to finish
I'm going to talk about the ultimate
teen
homewrecker movie, and that's a little ditty I like to call Poison Ivy.
Yeah.
Starring the one and only Drew Barrymore.
Yep.
Directed by Kat Shee.
Yep.
Co-starring Sarah Gilbert and Tom Skerritt. Fuck, dude. Poison Ivy is so good.
Yeah, I mean...
It's so bad, but it's so good.
Well, we both bought that 3-pack.
Oh, man, dude. And I watched it after I bought that 3-pack. So good. I talked about it on an episode.
I need it to be in widescreen, though.
It's fine. It's fine. The thing about this movie is it's a total sleaze fest, but it was put up by New Line Cinema, which was a fairly big studio.
Yeah.
And it's got Drew Barrymore in it, for Christ's sake.
Yeah.
And the scene of her seducing Tom Skerritt's character is fucking priceless. Like, it's so priceless. And she plays, on top of her being a kind of psycho, she plays the bad girl psycho.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, she wears like the knee boots and like the short skirts and all that stuff. So you're like, okay.
Yeah.
Sold. And then the homely girl, Sarah Gilbert, is like the one who's like, oh, I've got a wild friend now. Maybe I'm actually pretty. You know, that kind of stuff. And it's just got some dialogue in it that I just howl at every time I hear it. Just like, it's so out of place and ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like talking about like, there's just all this like sexual innuendos that are in the dialogue that have absolutely don't work, but work in the sense that I howl with laughter every time. There was 3 sequels to this.
There's 4.
There's 4?
I think there's 4 now.
Well, part 2 stars Alyssa Milano.
Yeah.
Check me off on that one because, you know, I like Alyssa Milano.
Yeah.
Embrace of the Vampire, number 1. part 3.
And these all had like the unrated version. Yeah, remember when he could get the R-rated or the unrated?
Yeah. And part 3 starred Jamie Presley.
Oh, for fuck's sake. That movie. Oh, my God.
What? It's a good movie?
I just remember.
Wasn't part 2 kind of like
poison? Jamie Presley at that point was just like such a fox. Like, I just remember that one being in particular like one of the best of the erotic
thrillers.
Wasn't
Poison Ivy 2 called Poison Ivy 2 Lily because Alyssa Milano's character was called Lily in it? And then Poison Ivy 3 was called
The New Seduction.
The New Seduction. And then...
And it was Michael Debar and Jamie Presley.
Michael Debar is fucking, Ghoulies and friggin' Poison Ivy 3 back-to-back. Perfect.
But I just remember her getting naked like constantly throughout a movie and it was just... She was just such a babe back then, like, and it was the perfect, yeah.
And the thing is, all the Poison Ivy movies had the exact same plot. It was just her, like, getting a friend and then seducing the dad.
But I think part 3 was just the seduction. Like, there was no...
No friend?
There was no friend.
Oh, okay. And then part 4 was called, like...
The Secret Society.
The Secret Society, yeah. And that starred one of the main girls from that Degrassi, The Next Generation show.
Okay.
So I think that's the last one. I think there's only 4.
I think there might be one more, but we can fact check that later.
But yeah,
my phone's charging. So.
It's like when I saw.
You can look it up while I'm talking.
Mine's charging is dead, but my phone's dead. But when I saw that 3-pack before, even though they're not in widescreen, I'm like $10, okay. Yeah. And then the 4th Poison Ivy, I got at Dollarama on Blu-ray for $3.
So right,
I'm not going to complain, but I think Poison Ivy and The Crush are the two ultimate teen movies in this subgenre, and and Wicked might become one if
I have another one to add.
Yeah, add it, let's hear it.
I've talked about it before, but
I know what this is.
Dearly Devoted, aka Devil in the Flesh,
with Rose McGowan.
Yeah, I mean, this
I knew this was coming.
This
actually.
One is fucking awesome, and like again, like I've talked about it lots when I talked about it in What Have We Been Watching, but
and the sequel is
no one knows about this movie, and it is so good. And this was like Rose McGowan, like just when she was in that like Doom Generation time period. Yeah,
okay.
Like that time period was like 1998, and
when she was kind of like the hip indie girl, the hip alternative.
Yeah,
indie
she
girl.
Was kind of a bad girl, I mean, the same old story. Like she had ended up killing her mom, and then she moves to a new town, and then becomes obsessed with her high school English teacher, and he's got a girlfriend played by Sherry Rose, and there's just lots.
And
of,
she proceeds to mess shit up.
Yeah, I mean, Sherry Rose is the one who gets naked in this. Like, you don't see nude Rose McGowan, but she is just such a great, like, kind of like, she's just nuts and just, you know, and a bad girl, like just wearing the short skirts down the hallway at high school and that type of thing. And
basically like a live action hit me baby one more time.
Yeah, video. She's just really sexy and yeah, and really manipulative and really, yeah, really sells the like kind of like desperate obsession thing. And I thought Alex MacArthur, who's like one of those guys that he just doesn't come across as being a very good actor, but he's certainly memorable. Like I did enjoy his performance as well. And the friend, there's always the friend played by JC Brandy. She's in a punk rock band.
Wasn't it usually the friend who's like warning them and then they meet the Jennifer Rubin fate?
Well, or it's the friend like in this one where they're like, you know, she's the one that like introduces the, you know, Rose McGowan to like, you know, the school and stuff.
But okay.
Then Rose McGowan becomes obsessed with the teacher and kind of like casts the friend aside. The friend gets kind of jealous.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so that's definitely one of my favorites. Like Chris said, there's a sequel, Devil in the Flesh 2, Teacher's Pet. Oh. And that's starring that Jodie Lynn O'Keefe, and it was just kind of mediocre. I'm just seeing if I've got any other teen dreams here, but it doesn't look like I do. I did write one down called The Perfect Teacher, which I haven't seen, but it's starring David Charvet, and it's from 2010. And you're going to knock that down. I'm going to be mad.
I keep knocking his Blade Runner poster.
And that looked pretty fun, but I haven't seen it. And just another kind of honorable mention in this whole genre is one called I Like to Play Games. No, or not I Like to Play Games, which is, well, that also could be a crazy girl too. But one called Friend of the Family. But actually, I'll just mention both of them at the same time because they both starred a girl named Lisa Boyle, and she was another one of those like mid or early 90s like babes that was like,
yeah, kind she was
of,
like a playmate too, wasn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah, and she was in tons of those like
wasn't she in like one of the,
she was a penthouse girl, and
was she penthouse?
I think, well, she was, yeah.
Wasn't she in one of those like women in prison movies too, like Chained Heat 3000?
Yeah, she,
or
she,
like
she had like a good run of about 10 movies there, and then she just sort of disappeared. But yeah, she was a real fox at that time. And but this Friend of the Family one, it's not really a crazy girl movie, but it's certainly, it's like this family's having trouble sexually, and Shauna O'Brien, actually, who was another one of these girls at the time period, she's like this drifter that kind of shows up at the family's house, and then eventually has everyone having sex with each other, including her. So she doesn't mess up the family, but she kind of brings the family together. So it's kind of like an anti-crazy girl movie.
She brings them together, all right.
She's like the anti-homewrecker. But that was kind of a erotic thriller classic with Sean O'Brien, Griffin Drew, Lisa Boyle, Raelynn Salmon, like four of the kind of the best of the best.
All
that time.
Movie's missing is Worry.
Shannon Weary. Yeah. She doesn't belong with this group. And then I Like to Play Games was less about a family, but it was about an obsession movie where Lisa Boyle was like really into this like kind of crazy sex stuff, but she was pretty nuts in that one too. And yeah, those are just kind of few honorable mentions that don't quite fit the genre, but just wanted to put them in.
There's actually a sequel to Friend of the Family.
Oh yeah. Yeah. The Family 2.
Yeah, with Sean O'Brien's in it again.
Yeah.
Okay.
I like Sean O'Brien at that time.
I was just looking them up. Oh, look. And look who directed Friend of the Family 2. Our buddy Fred Olen Ray.
Yeah, and the first one was, I think, Edward Holzman directed it.
Oh, okay.
But like I said, if you're a fan of like this, the erotic sort of, you know, sort of soft corey stuff, that was definitely one of the best movies of that genre because it had... yeah, like I said, Sean O'Brien, Griffin Drew, Lisa Boyle, and Raelynn Salmon. Like, they were all, like, kind of, yeah, real good stuff at that time.
Man, like, I just can't believe how many of those things were, like, so prevalent in the 90s, like, the mid-90s.
Oh, my God.
Like, that's a topic unto itself, almost.
Like, and all of these girls had their own... Like, they all had their own fan base, and they were all stars of their own movies. This Friend of the Family is kind of like the Expendables of erotic
Expendables of erotic. It's missing Worry, though, dude.
It's missing Worry, and it's missing Tweed.
Dude, we've had some good ideas tonight. We're going to get together the 80s low-budget version of the Expendables with, like, you know, Rick Hill and all them, and then to balance that out... we're going to do an Expendables version of 90s erotic thrillers. Friggin' Shannon Worry. Shannon Tweed, Sean O'Brien. Who's some other ones?
Well, we might have to do something different with them than what they were doing back then.
You never know, man. You never know. There's a market for that now. There's a market.
Maybe.
All right. So that's it.
All right. Yeah.
So hopefully you got some titles to watch. Remember, these are all going to feel like the same movie if you watch them all in a row.
Yeah. Don't marathon this shit.
So space them out.
And as I said before, don't think these are good movies. Like if you're looking for real deep cinema, don't watch any of the movies.
Probably the best movie that we've mentioned in this entire thing for being an actual movie is Fatal Attraction.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it was nominated for Best Picture after all, for fuck's sake. I don't know why.
I wonder what won that year.
In 1987, it was Empire of the Sun, Steven Spielberg. Oh. Yeah. So, you know.
Making it even more bizarre.
Yeah, it's like a movie about growing up during World War II in Japan, or a movie where Glenn Close fucks a buried dude. Okay. What's going to win? I don't know. I'm confused. So, like I said, we do want to tackle actual more psycho girls in the future, but that's going to be an exhaustive episode, so be ready.
Or two.
Or two. But, yeah, this is kind of what we want to do with our topics now, just go off the cuff and talk about ones we like and maybe throw out a few we're really interested in seeing, and hopefully you enjoyed what you heard and you'll check some of these out. Connect with us on the usual www.thevideograveyard.com/GBW podcasts. That'll send you to iTunes, Facebook, Twitter, all that stuff. All that fun stuff that Josh likes to giggle about at the end of the episode.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for listening, and hope you have a enjoyable time watching some of the sleaze that we've just mentioned.
And remember, if a teenage girl comes up to you and all of a sudden is flirting with you, run the fuck away.
Unless you're a teenage boy.
That's true. All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night.